security forces clashed with Islamic militants on the island of Mindanao. The emergency measures have drawn criticism from human rights observers. In a letter to Congress, Duterte says the rebellion will not be quashed before the 60-day period of martial law ends on July 22nd. The current violence began in May when militants allied with the Islamic State group seized part of the city of Marawi on Mindanao. Under martial law, the military can control designated areas and detain suspects without a warrant. The government says the Islamic State group views the Philippines as a potential Southeast Asian base. Duterte on Monday pledged to push through a plan to create an autonomous Muslim region in the country's south, an apparent attempt to win more support from Filipino Muslims. Plans for the autonomous region were part of a peace deal struck between the previous government and a major Islamic militant group in 2014.
An organisation in Britain says 2016 was the deadliest year on record for the world's environmental and land rights activists. The London-based group Global Witness says in its Defenders of the Earth report that at least 200 activists were killed in 24 countries last year. It says severe limits on available information mean the global total is likely far higher. The report says 60% of the killings took place in Central and South America. It says Brazil topped the list with 49 deaths, followed by Colombia, Honduras and Nicaragua. In Honduras, the report says a female activist who was opposed to the construction of a dam in her community was shot dead in her home. An employee of the construction firm has been arrested for alleged involvement in the killing. Global Witness criticizes governments for failing to protect activists at risk. It also says investors are fueling the violence by backing projects that harm the environment and trample on human rights.
And hello. If you've just joined us, please stay tuned for our regularly scheduled program of Indigenous Talk Radio with the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
Find us on the web, ang-newswire.blogspot.com.
You really don't understand, do you? Hey man, don't you realize in order for us to make this thing work, man, we've got to get rid of the pimps and the pushers and the prostitutes and then start all over again clean.
Hey, look, nobody's pushing me anyway, okay? I mean, not you, not the cops, nobody, man. I mean, you want to get rid of the pushers, I'll help you. But don't send your people after me.
Oh, come on, John. Can't you see that we can't get rid of one without getting rid of the other? We got to come down on both of them at the same time in order for this whole thing to work for the people.
Hey, look, nobody's closing me out of my business.
Hey, man, I need my flesh and blood. You make me make a decision. I don't want to make, John. You're my brother, man. Can't you understand that?
Look, being brothers ain't got nothing to do with it, man. I mean, I got a right to live my life the way I want to live it. I mean, being rich and black means something, man. Don't you know that? Being poor and black don't mean shit. We're living in different times. When you and I were young kids, I mean, there were no heroes. We got all sorts of heroes now. But there are kids out there who look up to me, man.
Man, can't you see? That's just teaching black kids to exploit their own kind, and that's sick.
Well, it's not sick, man. It's sick when you get a chance to get out of a rat-infested ghetto and you don't.
Oh, wow, then you really lost your love for the brothers altogether then, haven't you?
I mean, don't be dropping that brotherly love shit on me, man. I mean, for 5 years I sat up in that place and you never visited me one time, man. You didn't bring me a dime, you didn't write me a letter.
Well, that's because I figured you wanted something better than dimes and letters and visits. So I tried to create some kind of organization that you could use to fight the system that's been fucking with you. You too goddamn brainwashed to use it.
I just wanted to see you, man. That's all.
Angry Indian Radio.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Stand up and fight for Indigenous rights.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Indian land! Indian land! Indian land! Indian land!
You guys have no jurisdiction here.
You are listening to the Angry Indian on Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Real talk for the fourth world.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Who are you? You don't know. Don't tell me Negro, that's nothing. What were you before the white man named you a Negro? And where were you? And what did you have? What was yours? And how did he take it? What gun did you speak? Where is your history? How did the man wipe out your history? How did the man, what did the man do to make you as dumb as you are right now?
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
All Indians, all over the land, all saying the same thing. This is our homeland. This is our birthright. They don't want any white man comes in here and tell us that you have to divide this up this way or that way. The white man doesn't own this land. Just because he has a gun, he said, I took your land.
Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
Transmitting from within the occupied Aboriginal territories of North America to the people of the Fourth World and all ships at sea. This is Radio Intelligente Indigena.
Internet radio for smart original.
Este es Aborigen Inteligente de Radio.
This is Radio Intelligente de Indigena.
Those of us who share your struggle for human rights and against apartheid have been somewhat disappointed by the models of human rights that you have held up since being released in jail. You've met over the last 6 months three times with Yasser Arafat. Are these your models of leaders of human rights? And if so, would you want a Gaddafi or an Arafat or a Castro to be a future president of South Africa?
One of the mistakes which some political analysts make is to think that their enemies should be our enemies. Our attitude towards any country is determined by the attitude of that country to our struggle. Colonel Gaddafi, Fidel Castro support our struggle to the hilt. They do not support it only in rhetoric. They are placing resources at our disposal for us to win the fight. That is the position.
Internet radio for smarter original.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Transmitting to the people of the Fourth World from within occupied North America, this is Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. Welcome along, Salutan and peace to all the original human beings resident on the physical plane. You have tuned in to Indigenous news, thought, and analyses concerning issues that matter to original peoples and other communities across the world living under neo-colonial, neo-imperial, neo-classist, neo-liberal, neo-literal, neo-fascist, theological, racialist, homophobic, misogynist governments, claimed states, and closed-off societies, and to the people, those that are persistent, those communities who are suffering and surviving with grace under severe anti-environmental oppression. I'm your host, the Angry Indian. editor-in-chief of the Aboriginal Press News Service, blogging to the people of the Fourth World from aboriginalnewswire.tumblr.com and aboriginalpress.wordpress.com and ang-newswire.blogspot.com, our main news portal. And along with my co-executive producer and master studio engineer, Ms. Guadalupe Morales, we welcome you back to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio, the official broadcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service, coming straight at you from Everyman Studios in Multnomah Nation Territories, otherwise known as Portlandia, Oregon State. I haven't been in here for a while, and I do apologize, but, you know, I'm just going to be straight with you. I don't know where else to go. I really don't know where else to go with this program. We've been on the air in some form for, I don't know, since 2001. We were one of the first 800 podcasts we had heard, right, in the world. And I know I keep bouncing around with the year like that because the Angry Indian websites, whether they were on, some of these early message boards, I used to have stuff put up on American Asian message boards, you know, as a Filipino, right? I got onto Native American boards, right? Black Indian, there was GeoCities, there was a bunch of things. In various, there's been a lot of black blog platforms that have come and gone. And then before that, you know, using free web spaces where you had a ton of ugly fucking ads to put up my little news articles. Then we got this going. I didn't even know there was such a thing as... they came around with the podcast thing after Mark Curry, right? Because he was connected with Apple and they were pushing iPods, right? Before that, it was called... Because you and I talked about this the other day, Luke, Internet Radio Broadcast, right? IRBs. And we tried to push that terminology to keep, just to keep Apple from monopolizing everything. Because, you know, frankly, Apple was not even behind the idea of podcasting for whatever reason. Supposedly, Adam Curry had to really promote it for about a year and a half. And there were, people working on what he did and started putting out their own shows, but he got it syndicated. But before that, various American Indian Movement bases, offices, groups, because it's pretty disparate. Yeah, I know there's all kinds of schisms and shit within AIM. That's not what I'm here to talk about today. Without having someone from AIM present, I'd rather not get into the discussion. They had the little programs where they would record discussions and, people talking about what was happening in the community, talking about what was happening with Peltier, right? Talking about what was happening with Dennis Banks, talking about what was happening with Bob Robidoux and Dino Butler when they was starting to talk a little bit about what happened with them in court in relation to Leonard Peltier and what happened at Wounded Knee. There's still a lot of talk I hear from people, again, in the community. And I'm not going to say, I'm so down with them, I'm in with them, and I'm getting this inside knowledge. No, it's not even like that. I'm not Lakota. I'm not a Plains person. So, these are things that I've heard, through the grapevine, things said to me over beer, what have you. So I'm not making any definite statements, but, in terms of what happened with those agents, in terms of what happened with, Ray Robinson, because nobody wants to talk about that. For those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, Ray Robinson was a black activist who disappeared in 1973 at the Wounded Knee compound. Now, he had worked with MLK. He had been a part of the civil rights movement throughout the South. I believe he was in Chicago, or at least had done some work in Chicago and the New England area. But it's pretty fucking interesting that you have a black civil rights activist who was killed during the 1973 occupation of Wounded Knee. And not one Native American would talk about this. I'm talking about people who were there. I'm talking about people who claimed to be there. You know, because, I mean, I told you, Luke, you know, I got into a really serious disagreement with somebody here about a month ago because, which is one of the reasons why I'm bringing this up, because I'm still thinking about it. He hates Walt Churchill, this individual. Now, you get a lot of Natives, and it depends. If they're political, they don't like his claiming Native, you know, background, but they still look at what he reads. You know, I mean, I've written at least two pieces, and one of them, I equated him to Grey Owl. You know, a white man who was not Native at all. He was British. Went to British Columbia, Canada, occupied Canada. Married a Native woman. Or set up house with a Native woman. And became, you know, pretty much started what we understand today as the environmental movement. You know, in the global sense. There's always been people. There was the cat that used to chop down trees. I can't remember his name right now. You can see films of him with Nixon and Eisenhower chopping down trees. I can't remember Yule. Can't remember his first name. But anyway, you know, you had cats like that. You know, nature men, mountain men. No, not trappers, but, you know, mountain men, right? Mountain people. Okay. But, you know, what we understand now as the environmental movement was started by a white guy that played Indian. It was an early example of cosplay, I suppose. And it's bizarre. I mean, two people I know actually have gone to Germany, because I know Germans. But, I mean, these are Americans who married Germans and went to Germany and came back and said, yeah, there's a lot of people who have teepees in their homes. You know, in the back of their homes, and there's all kinds of Sitting Bull photographs and things like that. Modern Germans really, really revere Native Americans, and specifically Plains Indians. And of course, everybody knows about Cherokees, right? So there's a history of this. So then you got Walt Churchill. But see, the thing about Walt Churchill is that, you know, he has made his claims to be Native. Okay, that looks shaky. I've met the man. You know, he's a really big, big fucking guy. And, you know, it's like, hey, he might be, he might not be. I mean, there's a whole lot of people in Oklahoma who pass for Cherokee and like to wave their fucking AKC pedigree cards and shit in your fucking face. You know, but they don't look Native at all. I mean, you know, they're like Heather Locklear. She is supposed to be, what nation is she? I forgot, but she's supposed to be, I'm not going to say supposed to, she claims Native ancestry, right? My mother used to use that to justify watching Burt Reynolds movies. She used to use that to justify spending money to go see Wayne Newton, you know? She used to justify that to send money to Oral Roberts. You understand what I'm saying? You know, to get her anointed prayer cloth or some kind of shit in the mail. So, you know, when she go gamble. What did I tell you? It was a while back, but you might remember, you might not. Ms. Angry and Nick is tired of hearing about it. But, you know, we used to sit and have to sit through The Price is Right because my mother watched the show because Bob Barker is Native. Right? So it was, you know, you had to do it. You just had to watch it. Like I said, when Oral Roberts came on with one of those revivals, I mean, she had everybody up and we had to sit in front of the TV drinking tea, you know, watching this. Because, you know, there was this connection. So here's Walt Churchill. Now, Walt Churchill may or may not be Native. I don't motherfucking know. The Kituwa band says he isn't. No one in Oklahoma seems to recognize it. I guess what I'm trying to say is, look at what I'm doing right now. I was going to start talking about, you know, work written and said by Walt Churchill, who fell from grace. Native people really wanted to separate from him after the statements he made about 9/11, right? The dressed as a roost and chickens, which he didn't say anything any different than Malcolm X.
But then again, a lot of people didn't like what Malcolm X had to say either, right? That's what got him kicked out of the Nation of Islam. Well, he was going to get kicked out of the Nation of Islam anyway. But that was the excuse. You know, kind of the way Wallace Simpson was used to get the Duke of Windsor, you know, out of being king. You know, I mean, he was working with the Nazis and they couldn't really do anything about that because that would be an embarrassment to the fucking family, but the family was German. And you had him, his brother, the Duke of Kent, one other fucking relative, right? The Duke of Saxe-Coburg. You also had a couple of cousins, right? You know, cousinhood. You know, because not all of them dropped their German identity. You know, I mean, some of them became British, they became Mount Bottoms, whatever, and all that kind of shit. But a lot of the German upper crust, which is basically, you know, what, Coburg, the city or the town itself. I mean, it pretty much spawned all of the motherfucking royal families from the British Isles all the way up to fucking Russia. Even though we all know Russia's Asia. But, you know, you get what I'm saying. You know, the Tsar's family was German. And he married a German woman, right? A German blue blood. So we wonder why the fucking revolution happened. Yeah, it was going to happen any fucking way, but why it came the way it fucking did. You know, part of that shit was used against it. You know, the idea that, you know, when you look at Lenin, you look at Trotsky, right? You look at Kalashnikov, the cat that designed the rifle, Brezhnev, fucking Yeltsin, Vladimir Putin, whoever the fuck. They're not Europeans. You know, I mean, they have European traces, but they're not European. They're Asian people. So there's that. But again, see, I just went off on another tangent and I apologize. What I'm trying to say is we get caught up talking about Walt Churchill's Indian claim as an ethnic identity rather than what the fuck he's written. Now, if we're going to get on him for the ethnic shit, go ahead and do that. You know, I mean, the same thing with Elizabeth Warren. There are Native people right now who do not talk to me because of the Elizabeth Warren thing. And I'm just like, look, she might be, she might not be. But see, here's the fucking thing, though. Why we're talking about Walt Churchill, you know, as a black Indian, right, with family who were owned by Cherokee in Oklahoma. Have you seen the news recently? Have you seen the Native news recently? Anyway, there's a move to get rid of all blood quantum recognitions, right? Which I'm actually down with. But what's going to happen with that? You know, how the fuck is that going to work out now? Because, you know, personally, I'm of and, you know, call this racist, call it whatever the fuck you want. You know, I'm dealing with a fucked up system. You know, I mean, Walt Churchill might be. And now in terms of being Cherokee, I mean, fuck. They have what? No fucking blood quantum claim, right? Am I getting that right, Lou? They have no blood quantum claim at all. You got to find yourself on one of the five of the fucking rolls. I mean, that's like what? 11, 18, 22, 33 rolls? But, you know, there's like five that they recognize. And I think there's only two that Oklahoma recognizes. And then on top of that, you got the community recognition. You know, I mean, I had a librarian tell me one time, because I went to check my own family shit, on how several people had just come in that afternoon who, you know, thought they were Cherokee, were hoping that they were Cherokee, and couldn't find their relative's name, you know, on the list, or at least the name that they could, you know, have some provenance to, you know, so some documentation for. Now, I found my relatives on the list, but see, but even then, see, his was funny. Now, my grandmother and a sister appear on one list, but the same woman, my grandmother, appears on another list without the sister, right? There's a male, father, two sisters, and then on the next list is just her. And, you know, and to be frank, you know, I was really kind of befuddled by that and didn't go through, because I couldn't find, how did I tell you how that worked out, Luke? I went to several libraries and got the Dawes roll, got the rest of them, and found that discrepancy, and then wasn't able to find it. Then I found the who I suppose is my great grandfather's name on another roll with no daughters. So it's, you know, it's a whole lot of bullshit, because what ends up happening, especially in terms of Oklahoma, if you were there when the Indian agent was there and you were willing to stand online for however many motherfucking hours, and in some cases I heard days, then, you know, you got listed and your people got listed. Now, if you were black and Cherokee, and if you were, say, not of Cherokee blood, but a black slave, but, you know, you're supposed to be technically a member of the fucking nation, right? Because you were born there. But, you know, no. Right? You were the slave. So you don't get counted. And then, like I was saying, if you were actually of mixed blood, right, you might get counted. You might not get counted. Because if you look too black to the Indian agent, they didn't count you. You were a nigga. If you look Indian enough, then they counted you. But you got to understand something. They were trying to limit the fucking numbers of Cherokee people in the fucking first place, especially once they found that there was oil there. Look up Bill Tillman, the legendary lawman. He was brought in there before, when Oklahoma was still a fucking a territory. You know, before it became a statehood, when they first found oil and it became a fucking oil town. And what happened to the fucking natives that were there, right? Because you already had some Cherokee that left early and went there. Then you had the others, like my family, that was, you know, carrying the luggage and shit for their fucking slave masters along the Trail of Tears. Because they took their niggas with them, okay? They took their slaves with them. So, you know, for people who, like, you know, I have no knock with the Van family. I have nothing like that going on with the Van family. But I got to tell you, you know, I'm not making that goddamn argument that they've made. I don't give a fuck if the Cherokee accept me. You know, I really don't. Because they were slave owners. You know, it no more so than I go out of my way. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you know, and I've said this before. I am indigenous by fucking blood. All right? Through my Native American thing here. And as a Gullah person, you know, I identify myself as indigenous. I identify myself as an indigenous survivor, especially due to my Gullah fucking, you know, understanding of myself. Because frankly, that's the nation I claim. If I have to claim a fucking nation, you know, we have Queen Quet, what have you, you know, I mean, she's out there kicking ass, representing us at the UN, representing us at all these environmental and human rights meetings and conferences that are happening around the world. It is bringing a lot of goodwill and a lot of understanding to the Gullah people, to the Gullah nation. And like I said, I claim that through my father, which is allowed in Gullah people. You can do it, you know, patrilineally. But, you know, with, you know, Native culture, right? You're supposed to go through the month. Now, yeah, I'm part Jewish, but I can't claim it. You know, it was my grandfather, right? Where am I going with all this? Well, in the United States, we got a fucking really, we got a really serious, you know, corruption here. Because I just finished saying, I went on all these goddamn tangents because I initially started talking about what Walt Churchill was about. But see, this is what I'm saying. We get so caught up in identity politics in a lot of cases. What Walt Churchill has actually written about Native genocide, about colonialism, about misogyny, right, and as it relates to indigenous genocide. I mean, you can take what Walt Churchill has written and apply that to all of the indigenous women that are missing, First Nations women that are missing between the Canadian and U.S. border. You can also apply that to our Spanish-speaking Native American, First Nations, indigenous / Aboriginal sisters who are missing on the Mexico U.S.-Canadian border. See, we don't talk about that. You know, I mean, the last time I heard any discussion about that was when there was a female serial killer that was going after men because of that. They talked about her and they talked about how fucked up it was and how crazy she was, but nobody talked about what drove her to fucking commit those crimes. I'm not sitting here saying she had a right to do that, but I'm saying nobody talked about what drove this particular individual to do what she was doing. We ignored her identity. We ignored her identity totally as a woman and as an indigenous woman. Because I bet you any amount of money, she identified as an indigenous woman of Mexico. I bet you any amount of money. So what I'm trying to say here right now is politically, we need to be able to get past these, I'm not going to say they're minor. I'm not going to say they're minor. But, you know, it's just really fucked up here these past several months, man. I've been getting, I know I've been talking about it. And if it sounds like I'm whining, hey, maybe I am. You know, because I really think that it's unfair when somebody like me, because I don't talk about the fuck I really do. You know, yeah, I do a lot of community work, but you think I make any fucking money for this shit? And yeah, I could have been a total motherfucking sellout because I've had those opportunities and I turned those motherfucking opportunities, positions, jobs, you know, women. You know, I turned a lot of that shit the fuck down. And then the things that I did take, well, you know, I'm the one that said something about the racism, about the unfairness, about the inequality, right? About the injustice, about what the fuck we were doing sometimes. You know, on how we were bending corners, you know, ethically and otherwise, to get things done. And then I ended up losing those positions. So, you know, when people say, oh, well, you know, you light-skinned motherfuckers, man, you get it easy. Well, yeah, maybe. But then when they realize that you're not part of their motherfucking program and that you won't sell out and that you're not willing to be a go-between for their benefit, what do you think they do? I mean, look at what the fuck is happening to Colin Kaepernick. I mean, it's gotten so motherfucking bad, he went to Africa. Now, I'm not saying that he wasn't already with that concept, but, you know, a whole lot of motherfuckers are not cutting their hair anymore out of pure fucking laziness and just following the next motherfucker. You know, just, you know, whatever the next man is doing, they just copycat. I mean, you see Republicans do it all the time. You can't get an original goddamn opinion or thought from these motherfuckers, man. They don't know what the fuck they're talking about half the time. They got nothing to fucking say. What are you talking about? You know? They are not independently thinking. So here's Colin Kaepernick. Because I've been in this position. And he's also got the motherfucking, you know, ready. He's got the dodge to do this. He got up and went to Africa. You know, and I totally support him for that. But he should not have had to do that to get your fucking respect. He's out here fucking risking his entire fucking career. Because if I understand correctly, I don't follow sports, Luke, but your husband told me that he hasn't gotten a contract yet, right? He's still being snubbed. Some of those other players are still catching heat. But a lot of them, yeah, they stood up or wouldn't stand up or whatever the fuck they did. You know, they did their little protest. They're not protesting anymore. You know, they might have their little words in the locker rooms and shit, but they're not protesting anymore. Kaepernick got left out there hanging. Jesse Williams, I've also brought him up because he got fucking slammed. And he's still getting slammed. I still hear motherfuckers talking shit about Colin Kaepernick. Oh, he's light-skinned, he ain't really black. I still hear shit about Jesse Williams. Well, he's light-skinned, he ain't really black. Now, look, I'm just bringing these two particular cats up because they're the only two right now that I can think of, you know, by name. As some of you know, I do not watch television. I do not listen to modern music. I don't know what I do not know what the fuck is going on. I don't. When it comes to hipster shit, I know what I see on the street and what people tell me that, you know, their children are doing. That's it. If it doesn't pop up in the news, I'm not paying attention to it. I'm not interested in it, frankly. Right? I mean, I listen to what I listen to, but I'm not trying to keep up with pop culture, man. I'm doing my thing. And I'm telling you, you know, the froze and the natural hair, it's all good, but where's the consciousness behind it? You're only doing this shit because it's in fashion. And right now it's in fashion to jump on people who take, you know, pro-ethnic stances. And I'm not talking about Rachel Dolezal. Rachel Dolezal is a fucking fraud. But she's a part of what the fuck I'm talking about. Now, if you want to connect her to a war Churchill, you know what? You might be able to do that. You seriously might be able to do that. But, you know, I frankly don't give a fuck about Dolezal in terms of defense. I say what I say about her because I want to. You know, I think I'm in a position to say that. You know, because here it is. I got a gullah father. I mean, my father's black Indian, but I mean, he's black. And I catch hell because my mother's native from fucking Jewish. You know what I'm saying? I catch hell. And I'm out here fighting. I'm out here. I have fought neo-Nazis. These same motherfucking, you know, brothers and shit, especially these Hotep cats. and talk the most crap to me would never challenge a motherfucking neo-Nazi. You hear what I'm saying? They would never challenge a fucking neo-Nazi. They would never challenge one of these alt-right motherfuckers. They would never challenge a Klansman. See, I've done this shit. And I got the motherfucking marks to prove it. I've done this. And it's not that I'm tough or anything like that. It's just I'm not going to motherfucking be afraid to walk down streets that I goddamn live on in the motherfucking country that I was here before the Europeans fucking got here. I am not afraid of Nazis. I'm afraid of what they'll do. I'm concerned about what they will do. Because we know that they're fucking crazy. See, we've allowed them, while motherfuckers are sitting right here talking about Jesse Williams and demeaning him, they should have put that motherfucking energy, right, into counteracting this goddamn fascist movement out here. But if you notice, the only people I see that are black that are out here asking, challenging the white supremacists are fucking black communists, black anarchists. I'm sorry, Afropunk, but you're not there. I hear you talking a lot, though, but you're not there. I mean, those of you who are political, okay, you're political, but you don't speak for the group, you know, and that's something else we got to get used to. That's something else that we have to get used to, this idea that one individual speaks for a group. You're letting white people, and see, that's hypocrisy to me, because, I'm a nigger. I'm not an African-American, whatever. I'm a nigger, man. You know, I'm down with the hip-hop universe because that's where this is coming from. And I identify as a nigger. See, people take me out of context. I use nigger all the time in context. You know, bitch, hey, there used to be some context to that. Now I hear black women, white women, Latino women, Asian women, Native women. They don't call themselves women anymore. They call themselves bitches. And there's no motherfucking context. I see women out here with tattoos, bitch. On their breasts, on their leg, on their arms. Right? I mean, I've seen photos of chicks with bitch tattooed on their necks. Bitch. I know a guy. What am I talking about? He's got niggas spelled with an A across his throat. In Old English. Figure that out. I mean, I've seen nigger tattoos in Germanic. There's a little bit of a contradiction there, don't you think? So, you know, I don't want to be in here. I want to enjoy my tea while it's hot, Frank. And, you know, one of the things I was going into, same if I went on all these goddamn tangents was, you know, I haven't been in here because, frankly, Loopy and I really just don't know where to go. You know, what the fuck are we going to talk about? You know, the Trump-Russia shit, the fucking black left wing here is supporting Putin and Russia. Because, you know, some of them, most of them, I think all of them, somehow in the back of their minds still think that the fucking Kremlin is, you know, the building itself, the complex, is a communist organ. Of the Russian people, which it never really was anyway. It was a government just like any other goddamn government that went off the fucking rails like most governments do. But, you know, Putin was never a fucking communist. He was in the goddamn KGB. He was a functionary. He was never a believer. Yeltsin was never a believer. What the fuck are y'all talking about, man? You know, I mean, ask a Chechen. Ask a fucking journalist over in Russia if they're doing any good. Ask the African students, they've been getting stomped since communism fell in Russia. What the racism is like there against Africans, against Jews, against Tatars, against all of the fucking ethnic minorities in Russia. Ask them how it's been since Putin's been in, since he's brought the Orthodox Church back into the fray. Come on, you kidding me? Now, what I was trying to get into here, roll with me, what I was trying to get into here, is that we get into, like I just did, a big emotional fucking thing that sounds political but really isn't, about Walt Churchill's ethnicity. Now, like I said, you know, when it comes to the Cherokee, frankly, unless you're Kituwa or some shit, or, you know, one of the communities that never left, you know, like the community over there, North Carolina. I mean, because, you know, I mean, Cherokee is spread all through Georgia, Kentucky, Tennessee, right? You know, like Gullah, Georgia, right? You know, Sea Islands and shit, moving on down, you know, snatching runaway, angry slaves and shit, and Native Americans who got tired of it and ended up in Florida fighting the Spanish and fighting the American government at the same time. You know, nobody really talks about this shit. But, you know, what I was getting to is we get caught up talking about, you know, Blood Quantum, and now it seems that there's a group of natives that want to get rid of it completely. And then I just went on Indian Country Today, and I should link to this, or if you can, Lupe, when we finally edit this and post it, where there's a list of what percentage you have to be in order to be considered legitimate by any of these of the given nations that are recognized by the federal government. You know, so we got a bunch of contradictions going on here, right? Yeah, so in order to be recognized as native by any of these federally recognized groups, so first off, the white colonial government has to recognize the group first, even though the group existed before the U.S. got here. Now, I've written about this. The United States Constitution, if you look it the fuck up, makes it clear, I believe it's in Section 1, that the United States government cannot get into any contractual agreements with a lesser entity. So by fiat, they recognized every native nation as a nation when they signed fucking treaties with them that they violated anyway. You know, like we talk about the 400 plus one, you know, the one that was never violated, right? They violated all the others. So, you know, right off right there, that's a contradiction, because these native states should not have to give a fuck about what they're saying in D.C. or what the BIA, the Bureau for Intimidating Aboriginals, has to say about who they recognize as one of their own. So, you know, there's that. And then you got the idea that you have to be 1/32nd or 1/2 or, you know, 1/50th or 1/32nd or 1/25th or whatever the fuck. I mean, that's all legal bullshit brought, you know, that came about because of what the fuck I was telling you about earlier. When Cherokees, and this is why Walt Churchill might or might not be, same thing with the female politician, because I can't remember my name right now, and don't bother to bring it up because I'm really tired of talking about her. But her, you know, they're just like, look, they might fucking be. They might be. Like I said, you know, you go down there, there's a whole lot of Cherokee that just look white, man. They look white, they act white, and they sound white, and they fucking have the racist attitudes of the average racist white Oklahoman. So, you know, or wherever the fuck they are, because, you know, there's a bunch of people that, you know, they'll get racist with me over black shit. And then when I talk about being native, then they say that they're native. So somehow that negates they're being racist against black people. And then when I ask them where they've been with, you know, with the struggle that's been going on here for 500 fucking years, you know, they have nothing to say. Because they really identify as white people. And they claim to be Cherokee, because that way the idea is you can't tell them to get the fuck out. You know, seriously. That this is where the hypocrisy comes in to me. Because you get white folks that would be like, well, you can't tell me to leave, I'm part Cherokee, right? I got a Cherokee great-grandmother princess, a great-great-grandmother princess, and you can't get that. But those same Republican motherfuckers, because they're usually Republicans, would then turn around and say, well, Walt Churchill is a phony. And this other politician is a phony. And they'll all of a sudden want to side with Native people. And we get all caught up in this shit. What happened when that originally came down? We talked about that on the show. And you can look at the Twitter history on this. People came at me like a motherfucker with daggers, man, because I was not supporting them on slamming this woman about this shit until she proves that she's Indian. Well, you know, while all that was going on, the Republicans had fucking used that shit as a total goddamn diversion and fucked Native people and a bunch of other goddamn folks at that same time period. I can't remember what the case was. I mean, Frank, I can't even remember this woman's name right now. You know, I was going to say Christine Whitman, but it wasn't her. But, but you get what I'm saying. We got to fucking put things in some kind of goddamn perspective. You want to get on Walt Churchill for claiming to be Native and not being? Separate argument. What he's writing, though, that needs to be taken into account. Now, I know his credibility is shaky because, you know, what was that art thing I was telling you about Lupe, where he literally copied this other fucking artist but sold it as an original of his own. Now, I've seen all of the stuff on that. That was shady. Did not look fucking good at all. I'm not backing him on that. That's his business. He really shouldn't have done that. But as far as his credibility with the rest of it, I say look at his fucking notes. I say if you're going to read his book and criticize it, follow the motherfucking notes. Just like, you know, one of the main arguments I get into with people about War Churchill, and a lot of fucking natives too. A lot of natives too, who will say to me that his claim that 85%, well, it's not his claim anyway, that 85% of the natives, that the indigenous population here was wiped out by 1886. I forgot what the actual year was, but by the late 1880s, that, you know, 80 some odd percentile of the Native American population was wiped out. Well, that was the fucking Census Bureau that said that. That was the Census Bureau of that time period that said that. It wasn't War Churchill. He was citing an official fucking document, an official U.S. federal document, that between army actions and the fucking activities of independent actors, that was the language that they used. Basically, white people decided to just go hunt Indians for the hell of it. You know, wiped out 80%, you know, more than 80% of our people. We should be talking about that. Like I said, you know, the shit with him being not real, hey, take that into the fucking, you know, closed door sessions and discuss that and fucking ream the fuck out of him. I mean, it turns out that, what's her name? Andrea Smith has been claiming to be Cherokee damn near her entire life. She has recently found out, and I don't know why it took so long. Like I said, you know, with all this documentation, you would think, well, you know, if you're going to use documentation to refute something like this, it should be pretty much 1, 2, 3. Well, it turns out it's not 1, 2, 3. Or at least it doesn't appear to be 1, 2, 3 in her case. As strong as an advocate for Native women as she's been all of these years, at least 20 some odd years, right? Well, she's completely fallen from grace. Native people don't want anything to do with her now because they now look at her as a phony. So all of her work on feminism, on Native feminism, on sterilization of Native women, on the physical abuses of Native women as related to colonialism, and how that misogyny in the Eurocentric, you know, milieu has weighed down upon Native women. All of that's out the window now, apparently. We're not going to discuss it anymore because we found out that she's not really Native. So we're not going to talk about it. We're not going to discuss it. We're just going to pretend that she never existed. I have a problem with that. Like I said, you know, when it comes to the identity thing, if it turns out to be not true and this person is really, you know, pulling a fraud like these authors have done, okay, that's one thing. But in this case, you know, given the fact that now they want to drop Blood Quantum, yeah, and even though that's not even what the fuck I came in here to talk about today, that was the subject. I think we need to really start having a discussion about what identity is as it relates to indigenous people and how much we're actually going to allow the legal system that claims colonial rulership over us, to define how we define what that actually means. This is the Angry Indian, and you're still listening to Intelligent Aboriginal Radio.
This is Rebecca Pierce. I'm a journalist and filmmaker from the San Francisco Bay Area. You can find me at weirdsister.tv, and this is Aboriginal Radio.
Therefore, we are not talking about politics tonight. We're not talking about economics tonight. We are talking about the survival of a race of people. That is all that is at stake. We are talking about the survival of black people. Nothing else. Nothing else. Nothing else. And you must understand that. Now, why is it necessary for us to talk about the survival of our people? Many of us feel, many of our generation feel, that they're getting ready to commit genocide against us. Now, many people say that's a horrible thing to say about anybody. But if it is a horrible thing to say, then we should do as Brother Malcolm says, we should examine history. The birth of this nation was conceived in the genocide of the red man. Genocide of the red man. Of the red man. In order for this country to come about, the honky had to completely exterminate the red man, and he did it. And he did it. He did it. And he did it where he does not even feel sorry, but he romanticizes it by putting it on television with cowboy and Indians. Cowboys and Indians. Then the question we must ask ourselves is, if he's capable of doing it to the red man, can he also do it to us? Let us examine history some more. People say it is a horrible thing to say that white people would really think about committing genocide against black people. Let us check our history out. It is a fact that we built this country, nobody else. I'll explain that to you. When this country started economically, it was an agricultural country. The cash crop on the world market was cotton. We picked the cotton. We picked the cotton. We did. So it is we who built this country. It is we who have fought in the wars of this country. This country is becoming more and more technological, so that the need for black people is fastly disappearing. When the need for black people disappears, so will we. And he will consciously wipe us out. He will consciously wipe us out. Let us check World War II. He will not do it unto his own. Notice who he dropped an atomic bomb on. Some helpless yellow people in Hiroshima. Some helpless yellow people in Hiroshima. In Hiroshima. If you do not think he's capable of committing genocide against us, check out what he's doing to our brothers in Vietnam. Check out what he's doing in Vietnam. We have to understand that we're talking about our survival and nothing else. Whether or not this beautiful race of people is going to survive on the earth. That's what we're talking about. Nothing else. Nothing else.
This is APNS Public Radio.
Fuck you, Trump. We'll see you on the streets. Am I disappointed? Yes. But am I surprised? Hell no.
It clearly shows what the country is made up of, what the country was founded on.
I always describe the United States as a greedy, hypocritical, racist, white supremacist, evil, warmongering nation.
Donald Trump is just a symptom of a greater system that has basically f***ed up for my people for over 500 years.
To me, the United States was founded in violence, developed in violence, and violence is an American, U.S. American tradition.
The thing that's rattling around in my brain is all of this militarized police and the attacks and everything that's been happening happened under the Obama administration. And I can't help but question what might happen under a Trump administration.
Now we have a really strong enemy to organize against that causes us to say, hey, we gotta get our together.
Hi, I'm Buffy St. Marie. We have overcome many obstacles in our history as Aboriginal people. We've survived. Today, we must work together, become leaders in the fight to stop the spread of HIV/AIDS in our communities. We have to think about the seven generations ahead of us. It's a matter of survival.
I would like anyone who is listening to consider some thoughts that I paraphrase from the words of German pastor Martin Niemöller. You might not care if Donald Trump says Muslims must register with their government because you're not one. And you might not care if Donald Trump says he's going to round up all the Hispanic immigrants because you're not one. And you might not care if Donald Trump says it's okay to rough up black protesters because you're not one. And you might not care if Donald Trump wants to suppress journalists because you're not one. But think about this. If he keeps going and he actually becomes president, he might just get around to you. And you better hope that there's someone left to help you.
What's up? My name is Jasiri X, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really responding to the call, man, of my sister Rosa Clemente, you know what I'm saying? For men in hip-hop, really stand up and say, like, rape under no circumstances is acceptable, you know what I'm saying? Rape shouldn't be rapped about. It shouldn't be supported, you know what I'm saying? And I'm really feeling like, you know, especially after Rick Ross came out today and said what he said, you know, he didn't use the word rape, but he described a scenario in which, you know, he put something in a woman's drink and had sex with her, and she didn't consent. If you have sex with a woman and she didn't consent, that's rape. And we have to say no to rape. And beyond Rick Ross, whether it's Fox News or their viewers attacking Zelina Maxwell for asking men to stop raping women, whether it's Hollywood, you know, perpetuating, you know, this rape culture, you know, it's got to stop. It's really, you know, we got to take personal responsibility as men. My name is Jasiri X. This is One Hood.
There are many arguments against the death penalty. It's not a deterrent against the crimes that it punishes. Society who use the death penalty don't have lower crime rates than those that do. When a country abolishes the death penalty, they are not plunged into criminal chaos. But even if the death penalty did reduce crime rates, would it then be acceptable? The death penalty targets the economically disadvantaged, those who can't afford good legal counsel, those without a voice in society. There's a saying in the US, capital punishment means that those without the capital get the punishment. Statistics show this is true. But would it be acceptable if people from all sections of society were executed? Does killing a rich man make killing a poor man right? The death penalty is irreversible and results in the death of innocence. When someone is dead, a retrospective pardon is of little use to them or their family. Since 1990, in China, the Democratic Republic of Congo, Nigeria, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, Yemen, and the USA, there have been 51 recorded executions of child offenders, some as young as 14 years old. But even if no more innocents or children are killed, should we tolerate the death penalty? The death penalty is never acceptable. It abuses two of our most basic human rights. Everyone has the right to live, and no one shall be subject to torture. The death penalty obviously kills people, but it also tortures, physically by the brutal nature of execution, and psychologically by forcing individuals to wait to be killed. They wait, sometimes for decades, while others are led to their deaths. The horror of this waiting is unimaginable. Human rights are thus called because they apply to all human beings. They belong to all of us equally. An attack on these fundamental rights anywhere is an attack against all of us. The right to life is inalienable. It cannot be given, and it cannot be taken away. No matter how terrible the crime, in a world full of uncertainty, human rights are a clearly drawn line, a line between what is right and what is wrong. the line between imprisonment and execution. Every individual facing the death penalty is, whatever they stand accused of, still a human being. However much we revile them, however much we are outraged by their actions, however much we want revenge, they are still human beings. They may well have killed and tortured. They've crossed the line. But do we really want to join them?
Brother Charles is home. His mood's as black as his skin. He done the man's time, paid the man's price. Now he's back on the street, looking to even some scores. Welcome home, Brother Charles. The most outrageous, terrifying movie about the black experience you'll ever see. It tells it like it is, and the way some people think it should be. Welcome home, Brother Charles. When they're nailing the lid down on you, not much to lose by fighting back. Brother Charles has a secret weapon. His victims couldn't talk about it, their wives wouldn't. After you've seen it, you will. Welcome home, Brother Charles. They tried to take everything he had, including his manhood. A Crown International picture, rated R.
Only love that which is me. I love to see niggas go through changes. Love to see niggas act. Love to see niggas make them plays and shoot the shit. But there's one thing about niggas I do not love. Niggas are scared of revolution.
We declare our right on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the rights of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
In the not-too-distant future, wars will no longer exist, but there will be Rollerball. Two teams of lethal gladiators wearing spiked helmets and steel-studded gloves. Some on skates, others on motorcycles, battling on a high-banked oval track. A solid steel ball hurtling towards them with murderous velocity. Collision, flame, violence, death. Broadcast on Multivision to 2 billion hypnotized viewers. It's all a part of the game.
This wasn't meant to be a game!
It's Rollerball. James Caan, John Houseman. Rollerball, a Norman Jewison film, rated R, under 17, not admitted without parent.
You can't bring up, one guy sent me a very interesting thing about Barack Obama and race. You can't bring up anything other than that suddenly he's African-American. If you start to, you know, delve around the edges of, wait a minute, isn't he mixed race? Weren't we told that last year or whatever, biracial? Not allowed to say that anymore. Apparently, the mainstream media has dubbed him to be African-American.
Yeah, I was driving in today and I was seeing, because I saw this piece with him on 60 Minutes, and I thought to myself, he's very white in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought to myself, gee, can I even say that? Can I even say that without somebody else starting a campaign saying, what does he mean he's very white? He is. He's very white.
When a Muslim without a birth certificate has taken over the White House, you need a good white former junkie to show you the direction that America needs to go in. Beck, it's What's for Demagogue.
This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Head on RadioNetwork.com, an internet-based conversation radio experiment. Available most easily at headonradionetwork.com. There's a listen live button. Just jump right on it, and there you are. Or if you're on a mobile device, it's also easy to find us at TuneIn Radio, a nice app for your mobile smartphone, or Tuner Internet Radio, or Dar.fm, or Stitcher Radio, Streama.com. We are rather ubiquitous. I mean, if we got more every night, we'd be paying salaries, right? Head on radionetwork.com.
तपाईलाई थाहा छ नेपालमा पहिलो पटक कहिले एचआईभी संक्रमित व्यक्ति फेला परेको थियो?
थाहा छ, सन् 1988 मा।
यतिका वर्ष बितिसक्दा एचआईभी एड्स को क्षेत्रमा के भए? सकारात्मक परिवर्तनहरू कति आए? कसले के गरे?
के हामीले आफ्नो जिम्मेवारी बहन गर्यौं? तपाईले गर्नुभयो?
जवाफ आफैसँग खोजौं। जिम्मेवारी बहन गरौं।
सामाजिक रूपान्तरणका लागि गगन गृहको एउटा प्रयास।
Do yourself a favor, get a mind transplant, listen to independent radio, the alternative media in general. This is Ward Churchill saying have a nice day.
Just when you thought it was safe to turn your radio back on.
I want to give my thanks to the organizers of this to invite me here. Are most of you law students? Some of us, okay. I was supposed to talk about political repression in the legal system. And I will, but I think I like to put things in a historical context. I think that one of the things that we really should try to understand is that we are living in a historical moment. And this historical moment requires of us some degree of analysis, of introspection, and of self-realization, if you will. Uh, Earlier today, I was doing I did an interview. We were talking about things such as the Black Panther Party, the political repression of the Black Panther Party, etc. Many people have the idea and the notion that the Black Panther Party was a failure, that the Black Panther Party didn't succeed, and that it was, in many respects, and this comes from a lot of black academicians who were hating on the party because many of them were cultural nationalists in the 60s, and they were wearing their dashikis and afros, and they thought their dashikis were bulletproof. And so a lot of them have this perception of the Black Panther Party as gun-toting street Negroes, street blacks with guns, who had no political analysis and who had no understanding of what they were really doing. They were just hating on the police. And many of you who are young, who were not around in the 60s, probably have read much of that in the documentation that you've read on the Black Panther Party. But you need to ask yourself, how is it that an organization that only existed for 4 or 5 years in actuality was able to transcend generations, still remembered by people around the world, still inspiring people and students to study and stand up and struggle? Many students and many people that I have encountered hardly remember SNCC, Student Nonviolent Organization Committee, hardly remember SCLC, CORE, all vital organizations in the struggle of African people for human rights in this country. But they remember the Black Panther Party. Even though their memory or how its accounts of its history have been distorted, they remember that. And why is that? You need to ask yourself, why is that? And the reason is not because the Black Panther Party had an answer to everything, or that they were especially revolutionary, they were so dynamic as revolutionaries that the U.S. government actually feared the overthrow by the Black Panther Party. That wasn't it at all. What was it? The United States of America, in 1967, in 1968, in 1969, in 1970, was in a historical moment. And the Black Panther Party found themselves at the cutting edge of that historical moment. Now, what historical moment am I talking about here? In 1968, the United States was undergoing a period of civil tumult. In Islam, we call it fitna. The United States was facing urban rebellions throughout the nation every year. Hundreds of cities were going up in smoke. Black people were demonstrating for human rights and civil rights in the streets. The image of the United States abroad was the image of a hypocritical nation that talked about freedom and democracy and equality, but yet the world was treated to the images of dogs attacking peaceful demonstrators, police beating women and children in the streets. The image of the United States was at its all-time low. But at this particular point, the United States was still empire. It was still developing the consolidation of what we have today, or what I call the national security state. The national security state wasn't completed in 1969. The consolidation of the right wing in America and white supremacy in America had undergone and was undergoing a severe challenge. What was this challenge? This challenge was for human rights, was for human dignity, was anti-imperialist. The streets of America were filled with anti-war demonstrators, hundreds of thousands of them. Young children, much like yourselves, the children of white America, were fleeing the country, going to Canada to avoid the draft. There was an involuntary military draft, in effect. The United States as an empire had an army that was constituted of draftees, conscripts. And it was fighting a war in Vietnam that was unpopular. And President Lyndon Baines Johnson at the time, in 68, right before the Tet Offensive, said that the United States was turning the corner in Vietnam. He had authorized sending 50,000 more troops to Vietnam that very year. And he had said that he had been promised by his military leaders and his military advisors that the United States was turning a corner in Vietnam and that the Viet Cong and the communists were defeated. We were seeing the light at the end of the tunnel. But you heard the metaphor, the light at the end of the tunnel is what? Be careful, it's an oncoming train. So Lyndon Baines Johnson told the American people that we were winning the war in Vietnam. This is 1968. And lo and behold, by December of 1968, the Viet Cong, so-called Viet Cong, the National Liberation Front for the Liberation of South Vietnam, and the North Vietnamese People's Army launched the Tet Offensive. And in hundreds of hamlets and towns and cities across Vietnam, the North and the Viet Cong took control. And this was transmitted into the living rooms of American people. They saw the Vietnamese in the U.S. Embassy in Saigon just weeks after Lyndon Baines Johnson had said that the war was won. It forced Walter Cronkite to issue his first statement condemning the war in Vietnam. Much like the media today in Iraq, in terms of Iraq and Iran, the media was a cheerleader of the Vietnam War. It encouraged the elites of America to wage this imperialist war. So 68, when the Viet Cong launched the Tet Offensive, and the streets of America were filled with rebellious youth protesting the war, black people protesting second-class citizenship. In France and in Europe, the students were going on strike. In France, for instance, the students went on strike and the French workers went out in sympathy with them in 1968. And it closed down the whole French Republic. It threatened the very existence of France as a republic. At the same time that this was happening in 1968, liberation movements in Africa were beginning to get support and aid from the United States Cold War enemy, the Soviet Union, and were beginning to show headway in the liberation struggles in Africa, defeating the imperialists almost at every turn. All of these events in 1968 came together to bring onto the world stage and onto the national stage Richard Milhouse Nixon. Lyndon Baines Johnson, after the Tet Offensive, said he would not run for president again. And he stepped down, leaving the door open to the Republican Party and Richard M. Nixon. Now, Richard M. Nixon, of course, we all know, had a history of red baiting and anti-communism. But Richard M. Nixon was no fool. He was a consummate politician, and he knew that in 1969, in that period, 68, 69, and 70, that he had to gain control of social culture in the United States, political control of culture, political control of society, legal control of its citizens. Now, we have to remember that in 1968, SWAT teams didn't exist. Did you know that? You always thought there were SWAT teams, right? SWAT teams didn't exist in 1968. In 1968, for instance, to give you an example, and this is very important to understand, you had major urban areas such as New York City, Chicago, San Francisco, LA, New Orleans, that had some of the most corrupt police departments in the country. The New York City Police Department was one of the most corrupt police departments in America. As the Knapp Commission and the Serpico story would come out and prove. It was the Black Panther Party in New York City and in Chicago and in San Francisco that started organizing in the African community for community control of the police. community control of the police. Not decentralization of the police, but community control. And community control meant that the people in the community would control the policies and the standards of the local police department. That they would impose a residency clause, that the police should come from the community that they worked in. Because most of the African communities were policed by white policemen who didn't live in the city, who didn't live in the community. They were an occupying army in the black community. And their sole purpose in the black community was not to defend African people from criminal activity, but to impose the status quo's will on people of African ancestry, to brutalize them, to murder them in the name of the law. You have to remember that to this very day, the United States does not admit to having political prisoners. To this very day, 20 or so years after COINTELPRO, America has no political prisoners. But I'm going to come to that for the benefit of our law students. But for the benefit of those who are a little more eclectic in their studies, I want to point out to you that this period of time, 68, 69, 70, marked a crucial period in America's transition from a bourgeois democracy to democratic fascism that we have today. So when Richard Nixon came into power, he saw all of this turmoil and tumult in America, and he says, well, we got to get control. Lacking a national police force, what was he to do? The FBI under J. Edgar Hoover was conducting a covert program called the Counterintelligence Program that initially started, its first practices were initially carried out against Marcus Mosiah Garvey, the head of the United Negro Improvement Association. Now, without going into the history of the UNIA and Garvey, suffice it to say that the techniques of the counterintelligence program that were to be developed in the 50s against the Communist Party, and that was used against black nationalists in the before World War I and after World War I and in between the wars, these techniques were first used and utilized on the plantations in the United States. Simple techniques, you know, hanging people from trees, you know, death of a thousand cuts, waterboarding. Y'all just heard of that. Crackers used to do that to Africans on the plantation on a regular basis. It's nothing new. These techniques all existed. These techniques of torture, divide and conquer, internalization of hatred to the point of self-hatred. All of these techniques, you know, more than two Negroes in one place at a time constituted the conspiracy. The only time Africans were allowed to get together were in church on Sundays, or at, you know, Catfish Row on Sundays. And who they had to listen to? They had to listen to the minister. And you know how that turned out. We wound up with Jesse today. We're still listening to ministers. But having said that, these techniques of the counterintelligence program, divide and conquer, misinformation, defamation of character, arrest and coercion, physical violence, intimidation, terrorism, were all techniques that were employed in the antebellum South. But they developed and changed as America developed and changed. And by the 1960s, 1950s, America was undergoing a process of urbanization and the development of a global technological infrastructure. These developments, urbanization of America, the war in Vietnam, the migratory patterns of American working people, the struggles of African people for human rights, the struggles of women for their rights, the anti-war sentiments in the country, all constituted a nation about to explode. So when Richard Nixon ran for office, he ran on the ticket that he represented who? The silent majority. They weren't in the streets demonstrating. They weren't protesting the war. They weren't demanding better working wages. They weren't doing none of these things. There was a silent, suffering majority. You know, the same ones that Sarah Palin calls the real Americans. Same crew. I used to say back then, the silent majority. Every time I drove past the cemetery, I said, there's Nixon's silent majority. But he ran on this ticket that he was representing the American people. He was representing the people who didn't have a voice, who weren't out in the street demonstrating, who were hard-working people. Middle America. You know, Pabst Blue Ribbon, redneck, White Sox. Red, white, and blue. He represented them. But his problem was he didn't have a national police force to repress all of this protest and all of this movement. And you remember, those of you who've seen all the movies and stuff about the counterculture, you know about the hippie movement, right? You know about the counterculture, the Timothy Leary version of history, you know, tune in, tune out, you know, turn on, tune out. 1967 was the summer of love. Demonstrators were sticking flowers down National Guard barrels and, you know, gun barrels. This was the summer of love. This was a period where counterculture was beginning to supplant the mainstream culture, especially amongst the youth. And a consequence of this, of course, was that young whites began to interact more with black people on a very fundamental level. You know, like smoking weed together. Freaking out at concerts, listening to Jimi Hendrix bug out and play the guitar backwards. You know, jumping up and down like a puppet, you know, to the Doors. You know, even John Lee Hooker had a comeback. All the old blues musicians, Rolling Stones, were paying tribute to old blues. This was an era in which blacks and the culture of, quote, the counterculture began to come together. So Nixon was very shrewd. He said, well, we can't have this. This is getting out of control. So he ran on the ticket of representing the silent majority. He launched the war on drugs. He established an alliance with the Mexican government and began to spray the marijuana crops with Pacquiao, which was a form of Asian orange. He sprayed the marijuana crops with Pacquiao, Asian orange, and people started smoking that stuff when it came across the border and bugged out. But the war on drugs was Nixon's initiative. And what was the purpose of the war on drugs? To consolidate law enforcement. To politicize law enforcement. To give law enforcement the opportunity to acquire military skills for domestic repression under the guise of curtailing the importation of legal drugs. So he launched the war on drugs as soon as he came into office, and he established the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, LEA, L-E-A-A. And LEA was designed to provide federal funding to local police agencies. If you had two black people in town, you qualified for anti-riot government subsidies. Didn't make a difference whether the two black people in town were two professors or not. You were qualified for federal funding to prepare your police department to deal with racial unrest. This was the purpose of the Law Enforcement Assistance Association. And it was out of this particular program that the SWAT team training, the relationship between the military and domestic police became regularized and institutionalized. It was out of the law enforcement, out of the LEA mandate, that FEMA was formed. You all know about FEMA. I mean, all we have to do is just reflect back on Katrina, and we know about FEMA. But did we know that the Timothy McVeighs and the so-called right-wing all-Americans who support the Sarah Palins and the John McCains were all in state militias, began to become politicized in state militias that were given charters under the LEAA administration? Under FEMA. State militias were supposed to be first responders in natural catastrophes. That was the facade that was put up. But who joined these state militias? Ex-Ku Klux Klansmen, Minutemen, right-wing John Birch Society types, ex-cops, military people, they all joined these militias. But remember, these militias were supposed to be for civil response to natural disaster. So under the pretext of providing government services for natural disasters, the Nixon administration put in motion the development of a police state in America. These were the kernels of the police state that we now see in America today. And you know what held up that development for 10 years? What do you think held up that development until 9-1-1? What do you think held up that development until 9-1-1? What do you think changed Nixon's plans? Forced him to modify his plans, delay much of them, and abandon some of their objectives? What do you think forced him to do that? In one word or in three words? Organizations like the Black Panther Party. So you see, the Black Panther Party was eminently successful in its 4 or 5 years of existence. Its success lay in the fact that it delayed, if not postponed, the consolidation of fascism in the United States for at least 10 years. It was necessary for the government then to devise a new strategy to consolidate police power in the United States and to take away the civil rights of people in this country. As the national security state began to develop, and this is the same state that Eisenhower warned us of when he was leaving office in the 1950s. I don't know if any of you are familiar with Dwight D. Eisenhower. Any of you here familiar with Dwight D. Eisenhower? No? Yes? No? Because, you know, you got a young audience, you got to break stuff down for them. They think I'm talking about something that happened 100 years ago. This happened when I was your age. Yeah, you thought it was some ancient history, right? Don't say that. I'm not that ancient. But this is recent history, and it's very important. You know, Dwight Eisenhower was the president of the United States. And for those of you who are unfamiliar with his track record, he was also the supreme commander of Allied forces in Europe. He's the one, amongst many generals, that led the United States effort against Nazi Germany in World War II. He was the supreme commander. And he went on to a political career and became president of the United States. And as he was leaving the office of presidency, as a military man, he advised the American people to beware of the military-industrial complex. Because this particular entity was the most threatening entity to your human and civil rights. The military-industrial complex. You know, and then he faded on into history. But he was right. What was developing in the 1950s during the Cold War, and you got to remember what the Cold War was. The Cold War was finance capitalism's attempt to deprive you of the resources necessary to change America. Trillions of dollars were spent in the Cold War, preparing for what? For a confrontation that never took place. Preparing for nuclear war. The United States spent trillions of dollars developing a nuclear arsenal that it would never use. Soviet Union likewise. The Cold War was a false dichotomy in the sense that the protagonists in the Cold War never fought each other. Never fired a shot at each other. They fought the wars in the Congo. They fought for territory and power in Mozambique, in Guinea-Bissau, in the Congo, in Somalia, in the Sudan, in the Middle East. But they never fired a shot at each other. And so they spent trillions of dollars terrifying Americans into believing that the Russian bear was just over the horizon and was about to attack America. And that if we had to be strong, and we had to defend ourselves against this threat. I grew up in the Cold War. I was in junior high school and public school during the Cold War. And I remember when we used to hide under the desk during the fire drills. You know, if you have a fire drill here, what do? You orderly leave the building, right? You have to orderly leave the building, go outside, and stand in a place designated during a fire drill, right? Back then, that's not what happened. When the bell rang, you got under your desk because the Russians was coming. Serious. You remember you don't remember these old flip-up desks that used to have the part used to flip up where you could put your books in? Y'all don't remember. See, y'all got all this slick stuff and, you know, I don't remember none of that stuff. But I remember it. And we used to get under the desk until the all clear signal sounded. When all clear signals sounded, we came out. This false dichotomy, this Cold War, siphoned off trillions of dollars that could have went to develop America's infrastructure, that could have changed forever the lives of hundreds of thousands of people in the United States. It went for what? To the military, to the corporations that supplied the military with the technology they needed to maintain their supremacy and hegemony in the world. The Cold War. Trillions of dollars down the drain. And then all of a sudden, after Ronald Reagan's two terms in office, the Cold War is over. The Soviet Union collapses, and now America is supreme. Number one power in the world. And the American elite, their brain trusts and their think tanks write out this grandiose scheme of America in the 21st century. I don't know how many of you read it, but you need to go read it. America in the 21st century. And it talks about the United States military power and its supremacy and how this is unprecedented in the history of the world. Never before has there been such a thing. I remember Rome. I remember Babylon. We remember a lot of things, don't we? There's never been an empire on this planet that did not come and go. But the most important thing to understand is the process of empire. How does a nation develop into an imperial empire? How did the United States develop into an imperial empire? Of course, I'm willing to come back if the history professors invite me back to talk about this, and I'm quite sure I would provide you with some insights that you really didn't think about. But right now, I'm focused on the law students and their belief that somehow their career is going to effectuate change in this country. You know? And I want to talk about that because what developed from Richard M. Nixon's campaign to politicize the police departments, to create an atmosphere that would be conducive to the American people submitting to a police state, was very ingenious, and it took a period of time, but it worked. It worked. And what Richard M. Nixon did, despite the fact that, you know, he was hounded out of office, what he did was he created the foundation for what the Patriot Act would consolidate. Because in the Nixon administration came up with the Omnibus Crime and Safe Street Act, which was an equivalent, a domestic version, sort of equivalent of the Patriot Act. You know, every time that the United States Empire is in crisis, and it has to institute laws that the people know are against their better interests, it creates a terrorist persona, a threat from the outside, and then it passes legislation to address that threat. During the 50s in the Cold War, it was the McCarran Act. And the McCarran Act led to the House on Un-American Activities establishing a permanent committee. And you had to come before this committee, you were often summoned to this committee, To declare your patriotism. I am not a communist. I believe in the United States of America and all of its stands, and I'm not a communist. Everybody had to come in front of McCarthy and the politicians that sat on the House on American Activities and explained themselves. People were purged from their jobs. People were stigmatized. Whole careers were ruined. The McCarran Act. So when Nixon came into office, he had to have his act, too. What was it going to be, the Nixon Act? No. It was the Omnibus Crime and Safe Streets Act. But remember what he said. He represented the silent majority. And who was in the streets? Protesters. Black civil rights demonstrators. Militants. They were all in the streets. So he forced through the Republican Party, with their majority at that time, forced through the Omnibus Crime and Safe Streets Act. And it was out of this act that a whole plethora of other institutions evolved, many of them we know today in different names. So Richard Nixon was very important and pivotal in creating the atmosphere and the basis for what was to come next. And what came next? After the Cold War was over, and the Russian bear was no longer the boogeyman. We turned our attention to what? Who became the pariah of world peace and security? What became the major force against imperialism? Was it Marxism-Leninism? We know that by the late 1960s, most of Africa was already independent. By 1973, they all were, except for maybe one or two provinces, because, you know, the Portuguese are stubborn and they held on to the last moment. But basically, Africa was liberated. Kwame Nkrumah was overthrown. So the idea of Pan-African unity and the development of an African continent that was unified went the way of separate elites. To this very day, you have 53 African nations, and not one of them is a genuine African nation. Not one. They are all beholden to clones of, imitations of, European nation states. So we have come to a point in history when Richard M. Nixon ascended to power in the United States, where the United States was at a crucial turning point. It could move in either direction. It could move towards enlightenment and liberal change, empowering its people, providing for their people. Universal health care was possible in 1969. Because people had a better understanding of what socialism was and what it wasn't then. Now you ask the average American, what is socialism, and they'll tell you Barack Obama. Barack Obama is a socialist. Y'all didn't know that, right? Y'all didn't know it. He's an undercover socialist. He's the only socialist that was financed by every major financial institution in the country in his campaign. He raised more money than any other presidential candidate in history. History. He raised more money than Ronald Reagan and all of them combined. He was able to do that as an outsider. You know, he was basically an outsider. Nobody supported him. But he raised all this money. I know it all came from our piggy banks, right? Millions and millions of dollars came from our nickels and dimes that we contribute to the Obama dream. Yes, we can. Here's my dime. I'm down. Give me the Kool-Aid. So, Richard M. Nixon, in 1968 and 1969, created the foundation that would go on to develop. You know, we had the brief episode of the peanut farmer and Jimmy Carter. You know, because after all of these excesses of an administration, there always comes in a liberal regime that vows to change everything. And that's what Jimmy Carter was supposed to do. He came in vowing to change everything. He even appointed, what's his name? Somebody give me some help here. You know, I can't remember all these Negroes' names. You know, they just... Andrew Young, my man, Andy. He appointed Andy Young as the United States representative to the United Nations, and Andy thought he was really the United Nations representative to the UN, and he started talking to the Arabs. He started talking to the Palestinians. Yo, you know, we could work this out. The Zionist lobby went bananas. They went crazy. To the point where Jimmy Carter had to fire Andrew Young. Said he had no authorization to talk to the PLO and to Yasser Arafat and his organization. Of course, we know today that the United States does what? Talk to the PLO. In fact, they tell you the PLO is an integral part of the peace process. In fact, they are training the PLO security forces in order to keep in check who? Hamas. But we're coming to that in a moment. My point is, Richard Nixon, got to give Tricky Dick his due. Despite his shortcomings, despite his personal paranoia and insecurities, he laid the foundation for the modern police state that we are experiencing today and that we call democracy. The police departments of America were politicized during this period. Police associations became an integral part of the Republican and right-wing agenda. Their representation became important and essential. So by the time that Jimmy Carter came out of office and Ronald Reagan was elected to his first term, the great communicator had something to work with. He had something to work with. And It was Ronald Reagan's policies, domestic and foreign, that began to transform the gains that Richard Nixon had made, political gains on the right, into a movement and consolidated right wing. That would ensure his power for at least 8 years and would hound Bill Clinton for another 8 until we got George Bush the first. Then George Bush the second. This is getting boring, right? So where do we get these guys from? You know? And today, the peanut farmer is what? The foremost advocate of Palestinian liberation. Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter talks about Israeli apartheid. He visits the West, the Gaza Strip. He has a more cogent analysis of the situation in that part of the world than any of the people currently in office, including Barack Obama himself. This is Jimmy Carter, the same one that fired Andrew Young for talking to the Arabs. How come he wasn't like that when he was president? You notice how all these presidents, when they get out of office, they get militant. They get progressive. But when they was in office, they was quiet as church mice. You could hear a minute of protest. You look at your homeboy, Barack. I know I shouldn't deal with him, right? I really should bypass him. But I can't bypass him completely because you have to understand that Barack Obama is the man of the historical moment. He was chosen. He was trained. He was groomed. Now, if you think I'm talking about some Illuminati or Society of the Skulls sitting in some room with ancient Roman symbolism saying, we're going to pick Barack Obama to represent imperialism and finance capital. So it shall be done. It wasn't that simple. I'm not an advocate of conspiracy theories. I just want you to know that up front. I believe it is what it is. I believe people can analyze and see things for what they are. I don't believe there was a group of men sitting around somewhere. It has to be men because we know about power and misogyny. There's a group of men sitting around, have sat around for the last 500 years determining which way Western civilization goes. And that's the way Western civilization has went in lockstep. It's not that happened. That's not happened. That's not what happened. History does create men and women, but men and women make history. And we are in a historical moment. And I'm repeating this over and over again because you must make history. You have to change the course of fascism in this country. You have to make this world a better place. And you are living in a historical moment where you have to do that now because you have no other choice. So getting back to homeboy, the great communicator, he comes into office, and what is the first thing that he begins to do? He begins to propound a philosophy of capitalism that we've come to know as trickle-down prosperity. He begins to consolidate even more the power of the military-industrial complex. What is Ronald Reagan credited for? For building a strong U.S. military, right? A robust presence of America in the world. Here we have a nation, your nation, with 170-plus military bases around the world. Yet if you ask anybody in the administration from Obama on down, is the United States an imperial power, they'll tell you no. We're not an imperial power. So why you have 173 bases in 85 different countries and you ain't got nothing to do with imperialism? I mean, what's up with that? Well, the United States has interests. Last I heard, that was part of imperialism. National interest. Well, the United States has national interest. And its allies have an act. Now, who are the allies of the United States? Do you want me to get specific? Britain, Canada, Australia. You know, Germany, most of the times, after World War II, all the time. The French, ain't happening. Nepal. Glory was France. France used to be the beacon of Western civilization. And you've been to Paris, you know how arrogant the French are. Especially people of color. If you've been there, you know how arrogant. You got to cuss them out, slap them upside the face. That's the only way to start respecting them. They don't respect nobody else. So they have this cultural thing where they'll get down with the Americans and the British and the Canadians. But what I'm trying to point out is, with the exception of Germany after World War II, all of the wars and all of the battles that the United States has fought internationally has been in an alliance with other English-speaking colonies from Britain. English-speaking. You speak English? Speak English? Yes, English-speaking countries. The United States has always marched lockstep with the manifest destiny of Great Britain. So it's not a coincidence, and you need to analyze that aspect of history, because it's very important understanding where we're at right now and how it is that the coalition of the willing is who? In Iraq. Britain? Who else? Canada? Who else? Australia. You know, New Zealand's in there too, you know. But they're like little junior partner. You know? Was the French in the coalition of the willing? Not overtly. The intelligence agencies were involved. Were the Germans in the coalition of the willing? Yes, but they only provided medical personnel. No combat people. Ever since the Germans got their ass whipped in World War II, they've been down with America since then. It's like the bully in the schoolyard. After he beat your butt, you always is yes man. Yeah, that's right. That's right. Tell him, Joe. Because he done whipped that butt so long ago, you know where the side of power lies. That's how the Germans are. You see? My point is that the geopolitics that we are beginning to experience today had their auspices in this period. And even before then, in the founding of the colonies, in the liberation struggles that the colonies waged against their colonial homelands, the English-speaking people. You know, my wife asked me, she said she has a new professor, you know, at her, and you know, she's doing her courses and stuff. She has a new professor, and this new professor said that his major distinction, and this is a vignette, you know, I know I'm digressing, but here's a point to this. She has this new professor, and this professor told her that he's convening the class. He told her, well, you know, my major claim, I want y'all to know who I am. And he says, my major claim to fame, my major experiences, the two most important experiences in my life is I was struck by lightning. I was in a house that was struck by lightning twice. And I am an authority on terrorism for the CIA. I'm a consultant to the CIA on terrorism. So I said to her, why don't you ask this guy, what does one do to be a consultant on terrorism? How does one advise the U.S. government? What do? You go, you read books on terrorism? You go to the library, you Google terrorism. And then, you know, you research that. How do you deal with that? Do you go and join a terrorist cell and talk to the individuals who are involved in it? Or do you get involved in the movement so you could, how does one become an expert on terrorism? Because, you know, you got a lot of white boys that are experts on everything. That's how we got into this recession. You know, they're experts on this stuff. Goldspan? Greenspan. I'm getting him mixed up with somebody. You remember Greenspan when he was asked, did he anticipate this reception? You remember? Did y'all see that? Y'all didn't see it on television. You got to go to YouTube or something and see this. Homeboy, now, you got to remember, for over a decade, this man was considered the guru of finance capitalism. He was like everybody hung on his every word. It's like, so Mr. Goldspan, what do you think the economy will do in the next year? They were hanging on his words. So when they asked him, did you see this coming? Goldspan said, to be honest with you, I didn't have a clue. You gotta see this guy say this. This guy said, I never thought or considered things happening this way. I felt, well, you know, we could control this and we could control that and we could regulate this. But this, I got to admit, I never saw it coming. So, for those of you in law school who are told you have to learn the history of the writ of mandamus and the writ of habeas corpus and where it comes from and the great Magna Carta and how it was a tribute to humanity and it was a curtailment of the arbitrary whim of nobility and all of that crap that y'all was told, you know, think again. It was written by people like Greenspan, who were clueless. When you are in a historical moment, very seldom do you understand the moment that you're in. That's why we're having this meeting here. That's why we're here. It's very difficult to be in a situation like we are in and understand the forces that are at work against us. It's very, very difficult. That's why people make history, but history also makes people. Think of what would have happened if the Germans invaded the Soviet Union and Stalin wasn't the dictator. Who do you think would have won? There was only one person to his right that was more ruthless than him, and that was Joseph Stalin. And he's the one that saved the Soviet Union, whether you like it or not. If he was absent from the historical moment, me and you might be speaking German. Because if you remember, one battle on the Russian front equaled the entire force that was fielded on the Western front. The Battle of Kertch alone in the Soviet Union in 1943 had over 1.7 million soldiers on one side and 1.3 million on the other side. That's almost 3 million soldiers in one battle. Over 1,200 tanks on one side and 1,000 plus on the other. One battle. When you look at the Normandy invasion included less than 150,000 men initially. My point is that the great expenditure of resources and military power was used on the Russian front. If the Russian front didn't exist, the United States wouldn't have won the war. Or at least it wouldn't have won it in that fashion. So we need to ask ourselves, if you remove a person from history, what happens? Very important question. What happens? So you see that Obama, and my point is that the president that we have today, a black president, and you know, you have people crying and rolling around, black folks was like ecstatic when homeboy was elected. It's like, yes, we finally arrived. You know? Race is dead. The issue of race is dead. Americans, you know, George Will. I don't know if any of you are familiar with George Will. George Will is a right-wing political pundit who said upon the election of Barack Obama that his election was white people's emancipation, was white Americans' emancipation, and it's true. White folks finally got rid of the onerous mantle of white supremacy because they elected a black president. They were no longer, you know, racist. You can't say that America is racist because they elected a black president. Well, I beg to differ. First of all, Obama is not the type of black person that white folks really are afraid of. Maybe Michelle's ancestors are, but not Barack. Barack doesn't have any bullwhip days in his background. His ancestors weren't on the plantation getting lashed and waterboarded. His father came from Kenya. He was raised in Hawaii by white parents and went to Harvard Law School. How many black folks you know in Harvard graduated from Harvard Law School? And it was president of the Harvard Law Review at that. Obviously, homeboys are gifted, intelligent, and very articulate individual. But hey, man, so was Adolf Hitler. He was gifted, intelligent, and a very articulate individual. I mean, he led the whole German people to perdition. You can't get no more rhetorically effective than that when you leave people. I mean, that's like Jim Jones. So we need to understand that Barack Obama, and you know, I had this black politician the other day tell me, well, America, the reason why whites voted for Barack Obama in such large numbers was because they were tired of George Bush. And that their world around them was collapsing. You know, Fannie Mae went belly up. You know, mortgages were going up. People were not having jobs. And, you know, so white Americans were suffering, like we all were suffering. We were all feeling this pressure. So Barack comes along with a message of change. And white folks say, well, we really don't know. This guy is black. So let's give him the litmus test. What's your relationship to Farrakhan? Please, you know I'm not down with Farrakhan. Okay, you was in this church with Reverend Wright. And this guy talked about goddamn America. Do you say that? Well, I can no more denounce Reverend Wright or deny Reverend Wright than I can black people, but I'm not limited by them. Next question? Oh, well, he's cool. He's not a black nationalist. He's not an undercover black Muslim. You understand? So he's cool. He passed the litmus test. Now, of course, if he would have said, well, I've been in this church of Reverend Wright's for years, my children have been in this church for years, and I think this is a moment when America should reflect on its history and white supremacy and racism and understand what Reverend Wright is saying. I challenge, you know, academia, white academia, to come and debate this issue about racism and what he is saying is true or not. He didn't say that. He said, homeboy, I ain't with that. You know, you on your own. Me, I'm just trying to get elected. So, Obama, just like Stalin, and I'm not saying that he has the same ideology or he is a dictator like Stalin. Let's not get this twisted here. I'm not comparing Obama to Hitler or Stalin, because I know some of you will go away and write that. Bill Wahard came to Minneapolis and said that Obama was the same as Adolf Hitler. You think I'm joking. People will say that. And you're sitting here listening to me. Am I saying that? Am I saying that they are the same? I'm saying that the historical moment calls into existence the personalities and individuals that can take history to another level. That's what I'm saying. And be it villain or hero or shero, that historical moment does not discriminate. And so white America did not vote for Obama because he was black. They voted for Obama because he represented the American dream, dreams of my father, not nightmares of my ancestors. You see, he wasn't going to wake up in the White House with a historical moment and say, man, these are the same people that murdered and killed my ancestors. Let me call the 1st Air Force in and have them bomb the capital of Alabama. He wasn't going to get a flashback like that because it wasn't in his DNA. So white folks knew that what they were voting for was dreams of my father. Such a wonderful story. I mean, Hallmark, Disney could tell this story. It's a beautiful story. Father in the village in Kenya, and I could hear the music. And there's his father, you know, dreaming and wanting to be great. But you know, his father used to be a member of the Mau Mau. You didn't know that part, did you? His father was a supporter of the Mau Mau. You know who the Mau Mau were in Kenya? The Mau Maus had a philosophy. I guess this will sum it up. One settler, one bullet. The Mau Mau was the liberation movement of Kenya against the British occupation, against the British colonialism. And most of the Mau Mau leaders, including Jomo Kenyatta, who would come to be president of Kenya, were thrown into jail by the British. So Obama's father was a pretty radical dude in Kenya. But then again I said, he was raised where he was raised. His past, his history is what it is. And dreams of my father inspired white folks to transcend their fear of black people. Because here was the penultimate American story. I mean, you read the book, tears all in your eyes, you know, you start saying, oh man, this is wonderful. He overcame all of these things. I mean, he went to Harvard Law School. He went to Chicago. He became an activist. He could have been a member of any corporation. He could have been a corporate lawyer. If he'd have been a corporate lawyer, he would have never been president. We wouldn't be having this discussion. He went to Chicago to get trained by some of the baddest mittenmen in black politics. If you don't think that we've had some of the most heinous shysters in black politics to come out of Chicago, think again. Don't start me to name names because I don't want to talk about Jesse and all of them. But Chicago has been a hotbed of black opportunism and black political misleadership. So he went there and got trained, and to his benefit, you know, he did what he did. My point is that this is a man of the moment. Jimmy Carter was a man of the moment. Ronald Reagan was a man of the historical moment. Richard M. Nixon was a man of the moment. So don't think that the situation we are in today is beyond you being the person of the moment. Because it's not. Some of you sitting over there who are in law school might one day be the Attorney General of the United States. Then what? You're going to be like Shawcross or whatever that knucklehead's name was? Then what? You're going to say, oh, I'm Attorney General. What are you going to say? What type of laws are you going to say? Well, I heard a lecture about Daruba bin Wahab when I was in law school, and I ain't going to never, ever do anything but become a prosecutor. Because we got to keep Negroes like that in check. Because he's obviously crazy. White people very seldom confront white supremacy and racism and white skin privilege. Just as men very seldom confront male privilege. How many men you know in here will confront male privilege without women getting in their butt? Not too many. Because you know how homeboys get when they get together. Man, I'm telling you, man, them women, man, she be on. That's how they be. I'm telling you, I know. You know, last time I looked, I was a man, so I know. And so, you know, without that pressure, ain't nobody going to really fess up to anything, man. You know? Because nobody wants to be embarrassed. Nobody wants to feel like they're oppressing other people. Nobody wants to feel like they're unjust. This is just human. Nobody wants to be, I mean, some people maybe, but most people want to try to at least appear fair. Right? So, no one's going to lay claim to this. But homeboy said that, you know, I'm presenting this message of irreconcilable differences. And he felt that we should be able to go inside of the institutions and change them from within. I said, well, good luck to that. Because I have not known one institution in America that was changed from within. Do you know one? Where have all the reforms that we are talking about came from? They came from without. They came from people like you taking to the streets and making sure that these principles were upheld. In Islam, it's said to the Muslims, and this is a prerequisite to the Muslims. In Islam, in the Quran, it said to the Muslims, O ye who believe, let there arise from amongst you a band of believers who will enjoin the right and forbid the wrong. Enjoin what's right and forbid the wrong. Who will arise from amongst these law students who will enjoin justice and forbid injustice? Maybe the person that should be giving this lecture is a very good friend of mine, Robert Boyle, who's an attorney at law in New York State. And he's the individual that got me out of prison. Him and Liz Fink, a Jewish woman with weight issues. And a mighty fighter in the courtroom. A mighty woman in the courtroom. These are people who fought for me for 10 years without a penny. Why? Because they believed in justice. And they fought for justice. Not for opportunity, not for career advancement, but for justice. And I hate to use cliches, but as long as America denies justice to people of color and to people who are oppressed, there will be no peace. America will have to wage war forever. You know, it's very hard for an imperial entity with 170 plus bases around the world to do that with a volunteer army. And the volunteer army came into existence when? At the end of the 60s. As a result of what? Protests in the streets. When the 1954 Supreme Court decision was passed, in Brown versus the Board of Education, did white folks run into the streets talking about hallelujah? They resisted every step of the way to integration of schools. They devised every means and mechanism to avoid it. And then when they finally couldn't get around it, they had to agree to it. And then they start talking about funding for private schools. When the laws in the United States that weren't on the books, when there weren't any laws on the books to govern how migrant workers were being treated in the Southwest, it was Cesar Chavez and the movements of migrant workers who changed that. It was changed from without. When women in this country didn't have the right to vote, it was women who took to the streets, the suffrage movement. Look at the films that changed that. None of these changes came from within the institutions. None of these changes came from within. They all were forced from without. So this historical moment belongs to you. It belongs to all of those people who are part and parcel of the globalization movement, who understand what New Age imperialism really represents. It's up to them. It's up to the anarchists that's throwing bricks through the Gucci display windows. It's up to them to be the rage in the machine, to be the cutting edge against this, to the point where now you have no freedom of speech. Do you know that? If they were to convene today in this city, a convention to institutionalize war or to sanction war, another war, and you decided to come out and demonstrate against it, what would they do to you? They would tell you the demonstration, the free speech area is 1 mile from the venue. We'll have the cameras there. You can do your interviews there. We'll give you wireless networks access, and that's where you hold your demonstration, and the conference will be over here. And the people that you're demonstrating against won't hear nothing. Quite different than the Chicago riots during the Democratic Convention. Remember Chicago? They smelt the tear gas in the hotel. They had to go into their rooms with their handkerchiefs up because they smelt the tear gas. That's what the anarchists bring. They bring on the noise. Without noise, there's no music. What's the difference between noise and music? You ever thought about that? What's the difference between noise and music? Noise disturbs you. Music soothes and inspires you. That's the difference. So bring on the noise and disturb these bastards. They need to be disturbed. And those that are in the legal profession and want to pursue a career in legality, you should really research the auspices of these laws that we're talking about. Because you're not going to get it in law school. Have you heard about the Law Enforcement Assistance Administration from your law professor? Have you heard about it? Did he ever tell you about it? Did he ever tell you how the RICO Act came into existence? The Omnibus Crime and Safe Streets Act, how RICO evolved? It was evolved to do what? To fight the mafia and organized crime. That's what they tell you, right? But go look it up. Go ask your professor these questions. Say, I'm very interested in understanding the basis of RICO conspiracy theory. You know, a conspiracy theory that says if I know you and you know her and she commits a crime, I'm guilty. That's deep. I'm guilty, you guilty, and she's guilty. And actually, there's no degree in difference in the guilt. It's like the accomplice in an armed robbery, you know. So you know, in an armed robbery, you know, the accomplice is almost as, if a murder is committed in an armed robbery, you get a murder charge. Even if you didn't pull the trigger, you see? Of course, that doesn't apply to people like George Bush because he could murder millions of people and get away with it. But that's a whole different issue. My point is that you have to transform your career into something that's historically meaningful in the moment. And when I say historical moment, I don't mean the last 2 years or 5 years. It could last your lifetime. You know, Rome didn't collapse in a day. And America is sure not going to collapse in an hour. It's a process. It speeds up, it slows down, it moves here, it moves there. But it's a process. And it's very important for us to understand this process, how it's working on us, how it works. How do we begin to gather information in the age of information? We have so much information today, it's information overload. This is glutted information, and Huey B. Newton said that information is intelligence. That power is the ability to define phenomena and make it act in a desired fashion. Power is the ability to define reality and make that reality act in your behalf. That's what power is. That's why lawyers are always shot right after the revolution. Because their job is to define reality. That's the job. So the first thing you do is you shoot the lawyers that define the other reality and you put your lawyers in to define the new reality. I know it sounds cynical. I don't mean to be cynical. I mean to be truthful. And that's the bottom line. Lawyers exist to define the social writ. To research and define the social writ. To practice those definitions of the social writ in civil and criminal proceedings. And it's very difficult for you in this day and age to be in a profession that is sanctioned waterboarding, that is sanctioned torture, that has sanctioned imperialism, that has sanctioned military adventures abroad, that has sanctioned murder of innocent civilians. It's very difficult to be in a profession that has done that. And at the same time, deal with a nation and a government that is critical of irregulars who do the same thing. You know, ever since the bombing of Dresden in, I believe, 1944, civilians were no longer innocent. Civilians were legitimate military targets because civilians made the war effort possible. They supported the troops morally, ethically, spiritually, and financially, and economically. They were the ones that populated the factories, that made the guns, that killed the enemy. So civilians became a legitimate target by the leaders and the allies in World War II. And from that point on, the idea and the notion of terrorism as something other than a tactic of war is absurd. How is there a war on a tactic? What is a war on terrorism? That's like declaring a war on amphibious invasions. Terrorism is a tactic that is used and has been used by both states and non-state entities almost since the beginning of time. So how did you declare a war on it? You declare a war on it when your country is in crisis, when your empire is in crisis, and you have to consolidate the type of power that would deprive them of their civil liberties. That's why today, democratic fascism, the national security state, sees all of you as potential terrorists. Not potential contributors to society, not as individuals that can make life better for people, but as potential terrorists. We're taught, if you see anything suspicious or you hear anyone saying anything, report it to the local officials. That's what they used to do in Nazi Germany, remember? Have you read about Nazi Germany? What did the Nazis do? They had children snitching on their parents, brothers snitching on their sisters, sisters snitching on their mothers. Anyone that was critical of Adolf Hitler and the Nazi party, if you said anything in public, if you said something around an unguarded moment, you would disappear. Now, last time I heard the word disappear used in America, it was in conjunction with rendition. They disappeared. And the United States today under Obama is still running rendition camps in Kenya, in East Africa, in Eastern Europe. They're still running these camps. Right here in the United States, you have a Guantanamo in Colorado. You have almost all of the political prisoners that are in federal custody in Colorado. Imam Jamil Al-Amin, formerly H.Rap Brown. 23-hour lockdown in Colorado. One visit a month, one phone call a month. That sounds like Guantanamo to me. Same thing. How much time of recreation do they get out there selling Guantanamo? 1 hour. How many phone calls are they allowed to make? Zip. How many legal visits are they permitted a month? Zip. Who are they? Who are these people in Guantanamo who have fallen between the ideals of the Magna Carta in the U.S. Constitution? Who are they? These people who have somehow are outside of the purview of the Geneva Convention and the Convention on Human Rights. Who are they? Who are these people that don't deserve any justice? Who are they? What crimes have they committed to make them, to put them in this situation? What crimes have they committed? They are defined as what? Illegal combatants. Isn't that the term that's used? Illegal enemy combatants, right? Well, what category? Have anybody seen that category in the Geneva Convention? It's something that an attorney made whole cloth to justify what George Bush did. Now, what are the principles of Nuremberg? That those who facilitate genocide, that those who write about genocide to justify it, that those who contribute to the rulers carrying out genocidal policies are equally as guilty as those who carried out the genocide. That's the basis, that was the principles in the Nuremberg trial. You couldn't get away being the minister of propaganda and said you didn't have nothing to do with the extermination of gypsies and Roma people and Jews and people who and communists. You couldn't say that. I ain't had nothing to do with it. I just wrote the parameters of discipline. I just wrote the legal parameters for Auschwitz concentration camp. I wasn't running the camp. I had nothing to do with Dachau. That didn't work in Nuremberg. Was that an argument that was accepted in Nuremberg? No. Why do we accept that argument today? Why is it applicable to people like you who worked under the Bush administration, who justified and rationalized torture? How is it possible for the Obama administration to come into power and say that we're not going to pursue the violators of these laws when they have in their prisons political prisoners who've been in jail for 30 years? 30 years. Many of you aren't even 30 years old in here. These brothers and sisters went to prison before you were born. But there is no reconciliation around that. Whenever the powers that be are forced to change or are thrown out of power, they talk about reconciliation and they talk about reapproachment. When the racists in South Africa had to concede power to the black majority, did Nelson Mandela and the ANC go after the people that murdered Stephen Biko, that murdered and tortured thousands and thousands of black Africans? Did any of these cops stand before a court of law and were judged on their actions? No. The Truth and Reconciliation Committee was established. You know, and then the guy that murdered Stephen Biko could come out and say, you know, I feel bad about this. I really, you know, I just want you to know that, and the family sitting right there, the murdered man, sorry, you know, okay, see you later, you're sorry, let's move on. But when a black man stands up for the black community and defends the black community and is framed and put in jail like Mumia Abu-Jamal, he can't make parole. It's the nature of the crime that's so heinous that he can't get out of jail. But here these dogs murdered and enslaved an entire nation of people, and not one of them went to jail. Not one. Not one. Why? Because truth and reconciliation only occurs when those in power are overthrown. And there's no retribution, because retribution means redistribution of wealth, and it means foremost the establishment of justice. Which brings me to my final point, Palestine. Justice. Justice. As long as there is a contradiction in history that does not provide justice for an oppressed people, it will never be resolved. Never. Every conflict that we see today in the world has its root in a history of injustice that was never addressed. Whether it's the Congo, whether it's Somalia, whether it's Kenya, whether it's the Yemen, whether it's Saudi Arabia, whether it's Darfur, these are all historical contradictions that were created by imperialist powers that were never addressed according to the principles of justice. That's why the people continue to fight. That's why the contradiction continues to exist. And in terms of Palestine, we see that the United States has carried out a policy to support a European settler state in an area and a region of a world that is geopolitically important to Western civilization. The idea and the notion of the Middle East is a complete fabrication and idea of the imperialist powers. Before World War I, the term Middle East was never used. The term Middle East, Far East, and Near East is a geopolitical construct of the imperialists. Almost every nation that you have in that region, almost every nation, Kuwait, Abu Dhabi, United Arab Emirates, Jordan, Lebanon, all of these states were created by who? The Europeans. The Europeans created every one of those states. And they created every one of those states in a struggle, in a conflict, in a historical moment. And that historical moment was the end of World War I and the destruction of the Ottoman Empire. They used divide and conquer. Both Turks and Arabs were Muslims, but the Turks were the administrators. So they used divide and conquer. At the same time that the imperial powers were using divide and conquer, mainly Britain and France, to overthrow the Ottoman Empire and open up the territory of what they call the Middle East to European penetration and dominance, from that point on, it was necessary to establish a military presence in that region, a supreme military presence. And that military presence is the Zionist State of Israel. That's why it's there. And this has been a dream of the Europeans ever since Columbus sailed west to go east. Ever since Mehmet took Constantinople and turned it into Istanbul. This has been an objective of the West ever since, to establish a permanent military presence and control in a vital region of this planet, the so-called Middle East. And that's the purpose and the existence that Israel serves. That's the existence, that's their purpose. Now, what does that have to do with us here? It has everything to do with us here, because the United States subsidizes that entity to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars a month. But they have no money for inner city urban schools. They have no money to put our children, give our children a decent education, to provide daycare for single mothers. They have no money for none of these things that benefit the American people, but they got money to bolster a racist state that has engaged in apartheid since its very existence. This money exists. And who allocates this money? The Ways and Means Committees, the Committees on Foreign Relations, and who sits on these committees? Black elected officials. Black congressmen, black senators. When there's an important bill that deals with Israel, it's I. When there's an important bill that deals with Israel that has no effect, it's nay. Like the Goldstone Report. Look at the voting record of the Black Caucus on other issues that reflected on the Middle East and the war in the Middle East and the Afghan war. And you see that the majority of black elected officials voted yes in perpetuating those policies. But when it came to the Goldstone Report, which had no effect whatsoever on anything, they all voted no. So they'll tell me, don't tell me that I'm a pro-Zionist lobbyist because I'm infected by this, because I voted no on the Goldstone Report, but your vote didn't mean nothing. When it came to something that meant something, you either voted yes or you were absent. So what are you saying? We have black elected officials in our community that are more concerned with the existence of the State of Israel than they are with the black community that they represent. And how is that possible? Because of money. Because of money. The lobbyists provide funds and they provide moral sanctity to these politicians because they're not challenged by us. White people can't challenge these politicians. You can't even challenge your own. I mean, 80% of the people in the United States were opposed to the war in Iraq under the Bush administration, and the war continued. The war is still continuing to this day. The United States has been in Iraq longer than it was in World War II. And the guy that got elected to office to talk about he will go talk to anybody anywhere and do anything in order to bring about peace, who got a Nobel Peace Prize, this man got a Nobel Peace Prize just for being who he was. Because his whole speech, his acceptance speech, was what? About just war. Have you ever heard a Nobel Peace Prize laureate talk about how war was just? Come on. Compare that to Martin Luther King. But then also realize that what was being done was legitimizing a historical moment. That's what the Nobel Peace Prize represented. The legitimization of a historical moment. Because who else won the Nobel Peace Prize? Menachem Begin? They couldn't give the Nobel Peace Prize to Sadat himself, so they included Menachem Begin because they said Sadat put out his hand and Menachem Begin shook it. So they both get the Peace Prize because Egypt was the first state to recognize Israel. And Menachem Begin took a bold move to do this, so he deserved the Nobel Peace Prize. They said the same thing about the Clinton. If de Klerk brought about the reconciliation of the white population in South Africa, so now you have a multiracial state, and for that, you understand, him and Mandela gets the Peace Prize. So now, Obama gets elected to office, talks smack about peace and world peace and justice, and he gets the Peace Prize and gives a speech about war. And everybody said, well, it's all cool, it's all good. You know, this was like a Nobel Peace Prize in advance of doing something. This was like a Nobel Peace Prize on credit. This was like a debit card Peace Prize. You know, if you ain't got no money in the bank, you can't get it. You know, they'll really embarrass your ass in the store. You understand? Sorry, sir, it's not authorized. So he's pre-Peace Prize. And then he turns right around and sends 50,000 troops to where? Afghanistan. Good Peace Prize. You know, that's like giving a Peace Prize to Attila the Hun. You know, you brought peace because you murdered everybody. And it's all quiet now. You see? And then he comes up with a policy talking about, well, you know, besides just wars, we have to understand, you know, we can win this war. And I'm sending 50,000 troops to win this war because we know that we're having a new policy of engagement. In summation, I want to say that the historical moment that you're living in now, the legal system that we're struggling under now, the fight for our human and civil rights in this country, are issues that we all need to engage ourselves in from wherever we're at, from academia, as students, as just ordinary people. We need to organize ourselves where we are at, in our community, around those issues that immediately affect our lives. This world has become a global community. But at the same time, it's become a global community because of technology. Increasingly, people are relying on close-knit networks in order to survive. So at the same time we're dealing with globalization, we're dealing with a contraction of our idea of community. Are we indeed our brother and sister's keeper? And if we are our brothers and sisters' keeper, who are our brothers and sisters that we keep? Just those that we know or those from afar? What happens in the courtrooms in America directly affects the United States' position legally in the world. What happens domestically in America with immigrant populations, with poor people, with women, with the marginalized, the criminalization of whole entire communities, the creation of an industry of prisons, all have reflected themselves in U.S. foreign policy. So before the United States commits injustices abroad, it first must commit those injustices against you. And you have to accept it as part of being American, as part of this American exceptionality. That, you know, America is the blessing of the planet. It's the light of the world. It's the light of humanity. And we all should be proud to be American, because we are all part of that light. You are part of the light only when you step on the stage. Other than that, you're in the shadows. So I'm going to encourage all of you to please participate in the programs to support political rights of political detainees and the rights of political prisoners. Stand up for what is right. You're not alone, and you won't be defeated. You'll only be defeated if you don't believe in your mission and if you don't believe in what you're doing. When I was in prison for 19 years, I was told that I would never get out of prison. Other prisoners used to say, damn, man, you think they're really going to let you out? And every year that I was in prison, I was getting out that year. Every year. The lawyer says, damn, ever since I met you, you were getting out of prison this year. Every year. Because I would not let them define my reality for me. And you cannot let these people that are leading this nation to hell define your reality for you. And that's my message. Stand up for what is right. Let there arise from amongst you a band of people who are enjoying the right and forbid the wrong. Thank you.
Coming to you live from Northeast Jefferson County, Kansas. Your one true voice in Kansas. This is the Radio Free Kansas.
I'm your host, Mike Cadell, broadcasting from North Jefferson County, Kansas, smack dab between Kansas City, Topeka, Lawrence, Atchison. Easiest way to describe it. Put together quite a good show. Think you're going to like it.
Radio Free Kansas on blogtalkradio.com/HideInCockfire.
White society wants you to know that anti-African racial hatred is a thing of the past.
We are the Ku Klux Klan. We hate niggers. We hate Jews. We hate faggots. And we hate specs. We people need to get off your ass and wake up. This is America.
With white people showing love like this, who needs enemies? Intelligent Aboriginal Radio. The anti-colonial cure for mental slavery.
The Downing Street memo is relevant. The facts on the ground tell us there were no WMDs in Iraq and no links to 9/11. So, was the president misinformed about these issues? Or was intelligence being fixed to support an invasion? To read the Downing Street memo, or for news and information about it, go to the website afterdowningstreet.org.
This is Cindy Sheehan. George Bush, Dick Cheney, and others launched a war that took my son's life. Strong evidence suggests that in promoting the war, they lied to Congress and the American people, and that in conducting the war, they have targeted civilians, hospitals, and journalists, used illegal weapons, imprisoned without charge, tortured and spied on Americans without court approval. When Richard Nixon abused power, Congress held a serious bipartisan investigation that resulted in articles of impeachment. Ask your Congress member to begin impeachment proceedings against George Bush and Dick Cheney.
Sponsored by AfterDowningStreet.org.
You are listening to Angry Indian Radio, the podcast of the Aboriginal Press News Service.
This ends our news session.
Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Summery greetings from Gloucester, Massachusetts, which is why you might hear some aquatic birds in the background. Most of today's show will be taken up by an interview with James Forman Jr., whose book Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America was published in April by Farrar Straus. At the end of the show, we'll hear a reprise of an interview with Kayanga Yamada Taylor from June 2016 on a political strategy for dealing with the disgrace that is mass incarceration. James Forman Jr. is a professor at the Yale Law School. He's the son of the distinguished civil rights activist James Forman, who was most notably associated with SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, in the 1960s. The younger Forman spent 6 years as a public defender in D.C., an experience that is central to the analysis presented in his book, Locking Up Our Own, Crime and Punishment in Black America. In my opening question, I asked Forman to explore the limitations of the new Jim Crow argument, which he expressed in review of Michelle Alexander's book published in the Yale Law Journal. He demurred some, but what I was getting after is a point that he makes in that review, that while the original Jim Crow made no class distinctions among black people, mass incarceration does. Most of our present population, regardless of color, comes from the ranks of the poor. Just 1-2% of the people behind bars, for example, have college degrees, and the risk of a black college graduate going to prison actually declined between 1979 and 1999. There is no doubt that our criminal justice system is deeply racist, but saying that it revives Jim Crow obscures some important points. Okay, on to James Forman, Jr. The Michelle Alexander book, The New Jim Crow, has been a very influential thing. It's shaped the way a lot of people think about the problems of mass incarceration. I first became aware of your work with your review of her book, and then your book develops some of those themes. But the whole New Jim Crow model is not necessarily a fruitful way to think about mass incarceration, is it?
Well, I think it partially is. So I would want to start there, because I think in a lot of ways my book is building on that work more so than, you know, rebutting it. And so I don't think we can understand the history of this country, and certainly not the history of the criminal justice system, without really deeply understanding the role that racism has played in forming every structure of our government, of our constitution, of our legal system, of our criminal justice system, of our policing structures. And so I think that the New Jim Crow, and not just the New Jim Crow, but books like Just Mercy by Bryan Stevenson, Between the World and Me by Ta-Nehisi Coates, and many other books that are less well known, but that academics have been producing over the last 10 and 15 years, I think have done, and really more than that, 20, 25 years, have done an amazing job of documenting all of the ways in which indifference to Black suffering has helped to create the criminal justice system that we have today. For me, and indeed, those motivations and that critique is part of what led me to become a public defender in the 1990s. And what I learned when I became a public defender in Washington, D.C., and practiced in a majority African-American jurisdiction with a police force that was majority Black, and judges, many of whom were African-American, and a legislature that was passing gun laws and drug laws that was majority African-American. What I learned was that although that critique is correct in many ways, it doesn't tell the whole story, because I was grappling with why so many of my African-American counterparts in the criminal justice system didn't see it as the civil rights issue. I became a public defender because I saw this work as the civil rights issue of my generation. But when I go in and I practice in criminal court in Washington, D.C., and I have clients that are receiving extremely long sentences, handed down in many cases from African-American elected officials and judges, I have to stop and ask myself the question, is this the whole story? That is to say, is racism and white supremacy, which is central, but is it the whole story? And that's what I try to explore in my book, is the other forces that are at play that help to explain how we got to 2.2 million people in prison, 7 million people under criminal justice supervision. So I think I'm adding to that account as opposed to contradicting it.
So you open the book with some stories from the 70s of there was an effort in the D.C. City Council, and D.C. at this point had just won home rule from Congress, right? So we had a new city council, new mayor, new system of government, and they were contemplating reducing the penalties for marijuana possession at a time when that was a popular move. It's taken, 40 years to get back to there now. But what about that issue of softening the penalties for marijuana possession? How did that play out in the mid-1970s?
Well, this is one of the things that I found the most striking when I began the research. So I knew that I wanted to write a book that really tried to look at what's happened in our criminal justice system over the last 40 and 50 years through the lens of African-American elected officials, judges, prosecutors, police chiefs, police officers, and activists. And D.C. was the natural city to use as a study because, as you say, in 1975, D.C. achieved a measure of home rule. And what that included was the right to elect a majority Black city council. And through some quirks in our legal structure, that meant that the city council, after a couple of years, had the authority to pass criminal law, right? So what normally would be the responsibility of state government in D.C. was passed by this majority Black city council. In the first city council in 1975, which included, among other people, Marion Barry, who would later famously go on to become mayor, 11 out of the 13 members were African-American. And one of the first things that the city council debated was whether to decriminalize marijuana, which, as you say, was something that was being contemplated and had passed in a number of states. Jimmy Carter was even talking about it at the federal level as a possibility. In D.C., the push for marijuana decriminalization came from one of the two white members of the city council, actually, a guy with an unusual biography, Dave Clark. He went to Howard Law School. He worked with Martin Luther King organizing the Poor People's March in 1968. And he went on to become a lawyer for poor people himself before deciding to put his hat in the ring and run for city council. And he won. And he pushed immediately to decriminalize marijuana possession. What was fascinating to me was the opposition. The opposition came from principally African-American ministers and a black city council member, black nationalist, also a minister by the name of Doug Moore. And here's the crucial thing to understand about their opposition. Because if you had asked me before I went into this research, first of all, I would have been surprised to know that that had been the leading source of the opposition, given everything we know today about the damage the drug war has done to African-American communities. But more than that, I would have assumed, well, if people were opposed, they were people that just didn't have the black community's best interests at heart. But that's not it. It's more complicated than that. The black ministers who were led the opposition very much did so out of a real heartfelt concern that marijuana would be a gateway drug to harder drugs, including heroin. To an extent, many people laugh at that today, but it's important to understand that in 1975, the nation had just come off of its first real round of battle with heroin addiction. In D.C. in 1963, they tested everybody entering the D.C. jail for heroin. 3% of the people tested positive. By 1969, it was 45%. So this is an epidemic that's destroying black communities, and lots of members of the black establishment and influential African Americans are saying, hey, don't decriminalize marijuana, because if you do, our young people will start there and move on to heroin. Jackie Robinson, the baseball hero, went around to black churches and community groups in the early 1970s and said, don't decriminalize marijuana because my son, Jackie Jr., is a heroin addict and he started with marijuana. Right? So this moved a lot of the opposition. So it wasn't that they didn't care about black young people. They did care. They just underestimated the harms of criminalization, and they overstated the harms of marijuana use.
You say at several points in the book that we look and see this system now where we've got millions of people behind bars, you know, millions more under the control of the criminal justice system. And it's easy to forget that it took a whole series of decisions over the years, little decisions in many different jurisdictions, to get us to this place. I mean, this is a really complicated history. There's no simple story of how we got to over 2 million people behind bars.
Well, I think that's right. And that, in a lot of ways, is the heart of my argument. I think it's so tempting when we look at something so massive and such a profound human rights crisis. It's tempting to try to search for, you know, a particular speech. You know, I read book after book that says, you know, well, Nixon launched the war on crime and then Reagan launched the war on drugs. And of course, they did. They did these things. And those absolutely contributed. But what I want to point out to readers is so many of the smaller, tiny decisions that we barely even notice that in many cases were made by people who were much more well-intentioned than somebody like a Richard Nixon or a Ronald Reagan that contributed to this. So one of the stories that I tell in the book is about the city council member. Actually, it's the same one, Dave Clark, and how in the early 80s, he's bombarded with letters from constituents saying that there are addicts nodding off. You know, heroin has come back and people are sitting on my stoop and they're nodding off and they're bothering my kids as I walk to school, and you got to do something about it. And what Dave Clark does is he takes those letters and he sends them to the head of the relevant public agency. He gets a letter back from the head of the agency who says, yeah, we're on it. We got you, Councilman Clark. We received this complaint. Clark forwards those letters back to the constituent and you think, okay, well, he's done his job. But what's the agency that he sends it to? Does he send it to the head of the Department of Mental Health, the head of Addiction Services, the head of drug treatment? No, he sends it to the police chief. Because in this country, even somebody like a Dave Clark, who's a liberal, who's pro-legalization, somebody like him still thinks of an addict sitting on a corner, nodding off, bothering a citizen as a police problem, not as a treatment problem, not as a counseling problem, not as a mental health and recovery problem. The point that I make in the book is those sorts of tiny decisions like that, the choice to refer a letter from a constituent to the police chief rather than to the head of addiction services. Those choices, over 50 states, 3,000 counties across our criminal justice system, over 50 years, helped to produce mass incarceration. And just one more thing on that. It's not just the system that we think of, that is to say, the police, prosecutors, probation officers. It's also private employers. So I really challenge people. There are a number of stories in my book where people got arrested for small amounts of marijuana in one case, heroin in another case, and then they lost their jobs. That's not the responsibility of the criminal justice system in large part. That's the responsibility of private industry. So I want everybody who's listening to this audience thinking about this issue turning to themselves and asking, well, what are my employer's policies about hiring people with criminal convictions? Do we have a blanket exclusion? Do we discourage people even from applying by having the second or third question on the application form be, do you have a criminal conviction? In many cases, the answer will be yes. And what I want to say to people is you're responsible too, right? That's one of the arguments of this book is that we can't call this a they problem. We can't call this a them problem. We need to understand this as an us problem. We've created it, and we've got to fix it. And that means all of us.
I'm speaking with James Forman, Jr., author of Locking Up Our Own. Your colleague, James Whitman, argues that, you know, that the culture of America is deeply punitive, you know, going way back. These are just many manifestations of this longstanding punitive impulse. It seems commonsensical to refer an issue like this to the police department, but it also seems like the American reflex is to turn to law and order as a response rather than something more sympathetic.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think you see this in all aspects of our politics and culture, not just in the criminal justice system. But so, for example, you know, we're currently debating right now whether to, the Congress and the Senate are considering, and it seems likely that they will pass, who knows, something that would devastate and gut healthcare for poor people, for working people, for older people in this country, right? They want to destroy Medicaid, which is responsible for 49% of the births in this country, 67% of the people in nursing homes are paid for by Medicaid. That is just mean-spirited. And that kind of impulse, that notion that if you're struggling, if you're working class, if you're on the margins, we aren't going to do anything for you through government. What we're going to do is we're going to make life as easy and as good as possible for people at the top, and the rest be damned. That instinct, that's an aspect of the punitiveness, right, that Jim Whitman is talking about. And then it also plays itself out in the criminal justice system because – and you see these arguments all the time. Whenever there's a discussion about whether we should provide better health care for prisoners or better education for people who are incarcerated, somebody turns around and says, well, I don't have health care. I don't have – my higher education isn't funded. Why are you funding higher education for people who are incarcerated? To which I want to say, you're right. You don't have health care and you don't have higher education paid for. And those are problems. And as a society, we got to fix them. But because we're so mean-spirited in some of those other dimensions, then it almost becomes natural to become mean-spirited toward this class of people that we've, you know, defined as the other and we've defined as despised.
One of the decisions that got us to this this state of mass incarceration was the spread of mandatory minimums. And D.C. had a referendum on that. Could you tell us the story of the D.C. referendum on mandatory minimums?
Absolutely. And the mandatory minimums, I think we have to connect those to the related topic, which gets a little bit of less attention, but I try to connect it in a book, which is to the maximum. So the maximum available sentence is one issue, and then the mandatory minimum is another issue, and they're related. So in D.C., there was a move to revise the drug laws. They hadn't been updated since the 1930s and 1940s, and everybody agreed that they had aspects that needed to be fixed. They treated possession and sale the same way. They lumped lots of drugs together that should have been treated differently. So they needed to be reformed. But there was a push from African-American city council member by the name of John Ray and a retired police chief by the name of Bertel Jefferson, and him also African-American. And they pushed not just to rationalize the laws and update them, but to make them much, much tougher. And what they wanted to do was they wanted mandatory minimums, both for drug offenses and also for gun offenses, for possession of a gun during a crime, et cetera. And they wanted much longer maximums. And they got the maximums initially through the city council, and then they went back to the voters a year later, and they said to the voters, hey, your elected representatives didn't go far enough. They did not pass mandatory minimums, and they presented that issue to the voters. And in an era when crime was rising, heroin, as I mentioned before, was coming back again in the early 1980s. Lots of people were scared. The left and progressives didn't have great answers. They weren't presenting great alternatives. They really, the move from the left was just to say, well, don't do that. Mandatory minimums aren't a good thing. Treatment beds were underfunded. There was only one treatment bed for every 10 people who needed it at the time. And in such an era and in such a context, they were able to get the city's voters to pass mandatory minimum laws. And the important thing here to understand is that they passed in every part of the city and by a wide margin. So this was a city that was at the time over 60% African-American voting to impose mandatory minimum sentences that in the end would have devastating consequences for many in that same community.
And it's important to remember that this is, you know, this city, like much of the rest of the country, the primary victims of crime at this point were poor black people. They're the ones who are getting shot. They're the ones whose kids were dying of drug overdoses. So there's a definite desperation in the air, and people lurched after what seemed like a simple solution.
That's exactly right. That's a really nice summary of the situation. I mean, one of the things that I found when I went and did the research, A lot of the former council members have turned their papers over to various libraries and archives around the city. George Washington University has the fullest collection. And when you go and you read, and those papers include letters from citizens. And when you go and read letters from mostly African-American citizens to mostly African-American elected officials in the 70s and 80s, the pain and the anguish and the desperation really leaps off the pages. You see people writing and saying, you know, I feel like a prisoner in my own home. I feel like a stranger on my own streets. I cannot walk my child to school because there are drug dealers doing sales on the corner and I don't want my kid to see that. I can't leave him in the park after school because there's shooting in the park and there's dirty syringes and there's needles in the park. And over again, they say, you got to do something. You have to fix this. And here's the thing that I think is important to remember, and you mentioned this when you talked about who the victims were. The people who are passing these tougher laws come out of a history, right? These are African-American elected officials who remember when, for centuries, letters like that wouldn't even be written because there wasn't any sense in the black community that the mostly white elected officials were going to give anything, give a care, right, about those complaints. There's a long history of under enforcement and under protection in black America, right? Southern sheriffs in cahoots with the Klan, they said, oh, this is not homicide. That's just another dead black person. And they didn't use the words black person, right? So that history of under protection, now you have this generation of African-American elected officials coming into office in the 1970s and the 1980s, right? They're bound and determined to change that. They want to respond to those letter writers. So just as you said, grasping at solutions, right? This air of desperation, and in many cases, turning towards kind of short-term fixes. In part, we have to also acknowledge they did ask for more structural reforms at the same time, right? They did also say, and I have example after example of this in the book, of elected officials saying, yeah, we need more police, we need more prosecutors, we might even need more prisons, but we also need better housing and an end to segregation and jobs brought back to the city and better schools and drug treatment. But for those things, they needed the federal government to respond, right? There they needed Congress. They needed Congress to pass a Marshall Plan for urban America, right, to reinvest in black communities the way we did in Europe after World War II. They needed Congress to pass national gun control. But Congress didn't care much about those African-American letter writers that I just told you about, and so they didn't do it. And so the people that I'm writing about in this story, I think it's fair to say they had an all-of-the-above strategy to fighting crime and violence. They wanted to do everything, but we got in our community one of the above, and the one of the above that we got was law enforcement.
We're listening to an interview with James Forman Jr., a professor of law at Yale and author of Locking Up Our Own, published in April by Farrar Straus. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, under the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. And now here's part two of my interview with James Forman Jr., author of Locking Up Our Own, from Farrar Straus. Now that police violence and more routine harassments against black people, now that this has a salience in our politics that it hasn't had in decades, one solution that people offer is diversifying the force, meaning more black cops. D.C. had a predominantly black police force, yet that didn't stop all the harassment of poor black people, mainly young men. What are the lessons that we can learn from diversifying the police force? Is it the composition of the personnel or the structural role of the police?
Well, I think it's the structural role. One of the arguments that I make in the book is that, you know, I'm still a big believer in hiring more African-American police officers. But the reason I believe in that is that we need African-Americans deserve our fair share of good jobs in this country, and police jobs are good jobs. But we need to understand this as an economic argument and a fairness argument. We shouldn't understand police diversity as a mechanism or a method to change police culture, because I think the evidence is that by itself, it does very little. Just as you said, I mean, one of the things that I was struck by when I was doing the research is how long African Americans have been calling for police diversity. The first evidence that I get for it, and the word diversity isn't even used then, Martin Luther King Sr., the father of the famous civil rights leader, he is calling in 1940s in Morehouse Chapel in Atlanta. He says 105,000 Negroes need one black police. That was the call to arms for African Americans in Atlanta, which, along with D.C., is the city that historically has had the largest black middle class. And there were no black officers for 105,000 black, or as they said then, Negro citizens. So the push has always been there. But I think what we saw in the 1960s and 1970s is we saw African American officers brought into police forces, but the forces didn't change their training, they didn't change their culture, they didn't change their methods of supervision. All of the things that we see now that help to produce this crisis of police shooting and police violence that's getting so much attention, all those things remained unchanged. And we brought black officers into that system. And it was unrealistic, I think, to expect that black officers were going to do anything different until we fix the system.
And now we have an attorney general and a president who look like they want to go back. For 10 minutes, there seemed to be an outbreak of a little bit of reason about sentencing reform and maybe easing up on intense policing and sentencing. And now that's a memory, and we have a president and an attorney general who want to go back to the days of the war on weed and, you know, higher minimum sentences and all this business. What do you think of Sessions and Trump, and what kind of influence they're going to have on our criminal justice policy?
Sessions offers and utters shockingly ill-informed pronouncements almost by the day. He said, I mean, one of the most obvious and really, I think, kind of grotesque misstatements was when he said that marijuana is only slightly less awful than heroin. Well, you know, last year, 13,000 people died of heroin overdoses and nobody died of marijuana overdoses. So when your nation's chief law enforcement says things that if a first-year law student said them, we'd say go back and reread the material because you obviously weren't paying attention, that's a problem. Having said that, I think it's critical that we remember that Sessions' power and authority is quite limited. So the number that I would want everyone to focus on is 88. 88 is the percentage of prisoners in the United States who are in state, county, and local facilities. 12% are in the federal system. So that means that this problem is principally a state, county, and local problem. The same thing is true for law enforcement. 85% of law enforcement is state, county, and local, not federal. And so what that means is this is a system that was built at the state, county, and local level, and it's a system that's going to have to be dismantled at that same level. And Sessions, in some ways, is, you know, sideshow is too strong, But Sessions does not have the power to stop reform efforts at the state, county, and local level. And we've seen in recent years, including in the same November election that brought us Trump, we've seen that citizens around this country are noticing that mass incarceration is a problem, that it's immoral, and that it's costing us too much money. And they're electing local and county prosecutors who are running on campaigns of ending it, of ending wrongful convictions, of reducing the emphasis on the war on drugs. Last November, for the first time in my lifetime, progressive prosecutors won election in Florida, in Alabama, in Texas. These are tough on crime jurisdictions, in Colorado, in Chicago. Last month in Philadelphia, Larry Krasner, a civil rights attorney, won the Democratic primary for prosecutor in that city. And the Democratic primary is basically the general election because the city's overwhelmingly Democratic. He's a civil rights lawyer who ran for prosecutor on an agenda of we're locking up too many people. So these kind of victories, I mean, a guy in Texas who has the words not guilty tattooed on his chest, a defense lawyer, he ran in Texas for prosecutor and won. And so what this says to me is that the nation is starting to wake up too late, too slowly, not right, and certainly not completely. But we are seeing that the movement that has been building, you said it was for about 10 minutes. I think it's longer than that. And I think it's still building. It's a movement that's being led in many respects by people who themselves have criminal convictions or have been incarcerated, right? People like Glenn Martin in New York, like Susan Burton in Los Angeles. There's this new generation and a new breed of folks that are speaking up about their experiences and are taking leadership positions in the fight to create a more humane criminal justice system. And so I don't think Sessions is going to stop us.
I'm speaking with James Forman, Jr., author of Locking Up Our Own. And when people talk about criminal justice reform or sentencing reform, they typically lead with the notion of showing mercy to low-level drug offenses and nonviolent offenses. Most of the people in state prison are there for what are classed as violent crimes. So is it enough to talk about going easier on low-level nonviolent offenses, or do we have to be bolder than that?
We have to be bolder than that. And this is one of the things, you know, that I've been arguing for some time. You mentioned earlier, a law review article that I wrote a few years ago, and it's a point that I pick up again in the book, in the last chapter of the book, where I am critical of President Obama and Eric Holder, who did a lot. They did a lot of great work in the last few years on criminal justice reform in their last few years in office. But they and other people who have sort of pursued this issue have tended to focus on what we call nonviolent drug offenders. As you say, that's a majority of our prison population. It's about 20% of state prisoners in this country, a minority of our prison population, about 20% of state prisoners in this country are drug offenders. And I think the impulse is not just that we have the numbers wrong. It's also, to me, a moral question. So one of the stories that I close out the book with is a story of a young man that I represented in D.C. named Dante. And Dante had committed an armed robbery. He had gone up to a man at a bus stop armed with a knife, and he had robbed him. And he was arrested a few blocks later with the money in his pocket and the knife in his pocket. And he was facing sentencing. And I knew that he was going to get a long sentence. The odds were that he was going to get a significant sentence. It was a serious crime. And I started calling around to various programs in the city to see if I could get somebody who would give him a chance, because Dante did have a lot of sympathetic things in his background. His mom had been a drug addict. She had really left him to raise himself and his brother. A local gang had sort of humiliated him and then offered him protection if he had committed this robbery as a rite of initiation. And Dante was incredible with his hands. He was like this sort of master carpenter, it seemed like, in the making, if somebody would just give him training. But every program I called in the city would hear my story. I would talk about how wonderful he was. And then they would say, well, what's his offense? And once I said armed robbery, they said the same thing that Obama says and that a lot of the national movement has said in recent years, which is, well, that's a violent offense, and we're not going to be dealing with violent offenses right now. Eventually, I was able to, with the help of Dante's mother, actually get him into a sort of a fledgling program And I went to talk to the man who he robbed, which is a long shot, but I wanted to present him Dante's case because the man that he robbed only knew 12 seconds of Dante, right? He knew the 12 seconds of the bus stop. And I wanted him to know the rest of Dante. And I told him everything that I've just said to you about Dante's background. His name was Mr. Thomas. And when I was done, he said he would think about it. I saw him in court a few weeks later. I went up to him in the courthouse, and he pulled out some papers from his pocket, crumpled. And they were, one of them was Dante's confession that he had given to the police that night, which I had given to Mr. Thomas, and also Dante's apology letter, which he had written. And he thrust these papers towards me, and he said, Mr. Foreman, you asked me to forgive your client. He said, I can't do that. He said, but I am trying, and I can go along with this program that you described. And we went into court. The prosecutor was pissed. The judge was surprised, but they went along with it. The judge went along with it over the prosecutor's objection.
This judge was no softy. You had experience with him, right?
Oh, no. This judge is locked up. This is no softy at all. He had locked up. I tell the story earlier in the book about a young man that he had locked up for possession of a gun, who I had argued on his behalf. And that's why I thought Dante wasn't going to make it, because Dante hadn't just possessed a weapon, right? He had used it in a robbery, or at least it threatened with it. He had it in his pocket, but he let the man know that he had it. So no, the judge was no softy, but he did go along with it in significant part because Mr. Thomas had come to see Dante in his fullness, right, as more than the 12 seconds at the bus stop, as somebody that was worth taking a chance on. And the judge went along, and that gave Dante the sentence. And then I lost track of Dante, because that's what happens in the court system. You tend to lose track of the clients that don't get rearrested. You don't see them again. And years later, over 10 years after that, I was walking down the street in D.C. I was walking past a construction site, and I heard a voice that said, Mr. Foreman. And I looked up. It took a while because it had been so long, but it was Dante. And he came down the elevator, and we spoke, and I wanted to have a whole long chat because this was such a meaningful moment for me. But of course, I reminded Dante of one of his, you know, low points in his life when he was caught up in the court system and had committed this robbery, and Dante kept it quick. But he did tell me that he had struggled mightily, but he had finally made it through the program with this strict pastor. And he had finally gotten a full-time job. And now here he was working full-time on a construction team, raising a 7-year-old son, had not been rearrested. And when I left him that day with my eyes wet, with just overwhelmed by the emotion of the moment, I thought about the fact that he is the classic example of why these labels of violent and nonviolent don't work. We cannot have a reform agenda that attaches labels to people and says, if you fit in this category, then we're not going to ask any further questions. Because everybody has a story, right? I just told you Dante's story, but everybody has a story. I just spent 2 weeks ago, I gave a book talk at San Quentin Prison, right outside of San Francisco. And the guys there, everybody has a story. And so we have to have a criminal justice system and a reform movement that's dedicated to bringing humanity and bringing mercy and bringing compassion and bringing an opportunity for second chances and bringing a willingness to look at your whole story and your whole life. We have to bring that to every aspect of the criminal justice system, including the so-called violent offenders.
Well, finally, I mean, you did an awful lot of work on this Dante case, and you also had a few lucky breaks along the way. But how can we bring that kind of insight and that approach to the broader political question of criminal justice reform? Is there any way, you know, to make this Dante a model for the nation at large?
Absolutely. There's lots of ways. So what did we offer to Dante, right? What did he actually get? Well, first of all, there was no mandatory minimum sentence, right? If there had been, this would be off the table. So that's a lesson. He also got a job, and he got access to a job training program. When my clients in the criminal justice system tell me what they most need to not be back in the criminal justice system, overwhelmingly it is a job. And yet we barely provide any funding for good job training programs, despite the fact that all the evidence tells us that when you re-enter, for example, from prison, the most powerful thing that we can help anybody get is a job. For every dollar we spend on job training and job placement, we get $5 back as a society in return. And most of that return is from the reduced recidivism. Because when people get employed, when they get hired, they overwhelmingly don't return to criminal behavior. The other thing we can do is provide education to people while they're incarcerated, right? So for the people that are going, Dante avoided being locked up. But again, the same studies show that for every dollar we spend on education for folks behind bars, and here's the point of the story, we can't limit it to a category of offender. We can't say, oh, it's only the low-level offenders. For every dollar that we spend, we get $4 in return. And the one other thing that we can do as a society, you mentioned, well, I had time to spend on the case. Well, I had time to spend on the case because I worked at a public defender's office that was well-resourced. Less than 2% of our funding in our criminal justice system goes to public defenders. If we increase that to 5% or 10%, it still wouldn't be fair, but it would be a huge contribution to making it so that everybody had a lawyer that was able to work on their case, learn the background of the client, call program after program, maybe meet with the victim as appropriate, right? All the things that I did, those are things that people that can afford to hire a lawyer, the lawyer would do as a part of their job. So there's nothing extraordinary about it. It's just that until we invest in our public defender's offices, we're not going to have lawyers that are able to do that. There are some programs out there. John Rapping works for a program called Gideon's Promise that is working to reshape public defense throughout the South. They're doing amazing work to try to make it so that in places like Alabama, Florida, Mississippi, Louisiana, Arkansas, North Carolina, you can actually have a public defender who knows you and fights hard for you. So those are some of the things that I would put on the list for how we make Dante's story more of a model.
That was James Forman Jr., author of Locking Up Our Own from Farrar Straus. He'll be making three appearances in the Bay Area in the coming weeks at Book Passage in San Francisco on July 19th, at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco on August 8th, and at Marcus Books in Oakland on August 13th. You can find more information on these events and others on his personal website, jamesformanjr.com. There's no E in Forman, and Jr. is spelled J-R. And now a political coda, the conclusion of my June 2016 interview with Kayonga Yamada Taylor, a professor of African American Studies at Princeton and author of From Black Lives Matter to Black Liberation from Haymarket Books. Black Lives Matter really did grab the nation by its lapels and, force people to pay attention in ways that have not, they have not in a long time. But is that enough? Can this go from a hashtag to an organized movement?
It has to. I think that
I feel very old-fashioned asking that question, but
that's okay. It's the question that confronts every movement, right? Because we've gone in the last year and a half from the movement has done a tremendous amount to expose the range of police violence and to expose its systemic roots, which is to say that any thinking person in this country no longer believes that police brutality is just the case of a rogue cop here or there, a bad apple, you know, a situation that got out of control.
Police forces are no longer all white. They're very diverse now, and it's a complicated problem. It's about the role of the police in this society.
Right. And so the movement, it hasn't gone that far. I don't think most people are questioning whether we should have police or the role of the police. But it's legitimate now that people see that there are systemic problems with policing that can't just be dealt with by a sensitivity training here or there. You think about a city like Chicago, where Rahm Emanuel's handpicked commission released its report. And this commission was the subject of protest because people wanted community representation on it, didn't get it. So it's a bunch of handpicked people from Rahm Emanuel. This commission report comes out 2 weeks ago and says point blank that the Chicago Police Department have no regard for the lives of people of color in the city of Chicago. This is a shocking statement that is impossible to have imagined without Black Lives Matter. However, we have now reached the point where that's no longer good enough. It was good enough to expose the movement, very good at exposing the problems of police brutality. But now what we are witnessing is the resilience of the political establishment to protect, to coddle its corrupt police forces, its killer cops. I mean, there's some cops who get caught, and now city governments have to, quote unquote, do something about it. But in terms of deep systemic changes, we're seeing the resistance to that. There's all kinds of evidence that point to this. Even in Chicago, where this incendiary report comes out, Rahm Emanuel's response, first, is no response. He doesn't say anything